right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are one final time to talk some more Survivor 41. Dominic, 1 week ago at the time of this recording, we watched this whole finale play out. How are you feeling about the season now that we've seen it wrapped up?
I think I have complicated feelings about it. I feel actually a lot better about Erica as a winner, and I feel like I've really warmed to her both as a person and as a character over time, and also lower on the season as a whole. It feels like there's so much good coming out of the season, and just at every turn, it was being like either dragged back down or actively throttled by the powers that be here.
Yes, absolutely. I'm on, I think, a pretty similar page, although we will find out over the course of this conversation. I too feel like I have some complicated, mixed, whatever you want to call it, feelings. I think some of the biggest strengths of this season were also kind of hand in hand with some of the biggest weaknesses. So we'll see what emerges as we talk through this two-ish hour finale. Not entirely sure on the actual runtime of finale proper versus makeshift reunion show, but a lot to be diving into here today, so let's not waste too much time. Dom, I think as usual, let's talk through, for the most part, kind of chronologically here, but obviously feel free to skip around whenever it seems pertinent. Let's begin with our final five, who are taken to a new beach where there is going to be a new advantage in play. It's going to be a head start in this final five immunity challenge that Jeff sets up as, look, it's not going to be that much, but it's at least something. As far as I can tell, this was like a completely challenge-altering, perhaps season-altering sort of advantage up for grabs here, and I got the vibe that we only really had this kind of Easter egg hunt, word unscramble, whatever, because it seemed to me like the producers felt like, well, we need some sort of activity for them to do. I know there was a tie-in to the whole game within the game, and people who were paying super close attention had already somehow unscrambled what this clue was going to be over the last week or two. Shout out to Reddit and to the No Buffs podcast who are on top of this. But what did you think about just the mere existence of this advantage in the first place?
It did seem like the motivation was, well, we got to have something,
right?
And so we'll cast around for what that something is, as opposed to, oh, this is a good idea, let's look for an opportunity to work this into the mix. And ultimately, I think it's, for as impactful as it ended up being, I think it's fairly inoffensive in the sense that the fact that it's impacting part of a challenge, and it's the way it played out was, Ricard had to, I think, continue the streak and continue this perfect run to make it to the finals. And if he made it through the final five round, then he gets two shots at it, a final four. And so I think Xander probably wins that final challenge, although I think Ricard would have been, you know, in very good shape there too. And then even if Ricard gets bested at the first hurdle there, then he gets another shot in fire. And then you have this whole second conversation of, well, then is Xander meant to step down so that he can take on Ricard in fire and embellish his own resume, for lack of a better word, that way? So a lot of stuff spirals out of this. But ultimately, I think why I don't really care about this as much is once you've committed to the idea of, I just have to run the table from here, like, Ricard losing a challenge which otherwise he probably would have won because of this being in play versus the challenge in question is, I don't know, some like weird balance thing that would favor a smaller woman, or maybe Heather comes out of nowhere and just spikes something, or, you know, Deshaun actually shows some of that challenge prowess that we saw a little bit earlier in the season. A lot of ways that Ricard could have lost this without that feeling illegitimate. And so even though this is like weirdly unnecessary, it doesn't strike some kind of wrong note for me.
I think the reason it feels weird or bad or whatever you want to call it, someone who's better than I am at coming up with synonyms, hit me up, but is because of the impact that I feel like it was very likely to have on how the season played out, combined with the sheer lack of necessity to me. Again, I do feel like this stemmed from the producers feeling like, well, we need something for them to do on this afternoon where we have five people left in the game and we have a segment in the finale that we need to fill. And I don't think I would have objected virtually at all if the advantage weren't so significant. But regardless of what Jeff wants to say about how meaningful this was, it at least appeared to me like Erica had a very meaningful head start in multiple phases of this challenge. And when Ricard comes that close to still almost getting this necklace anyway, I am personally willing, and I feel like I have heard that Erica has even said herself in like exit press that Ricard would have won this challenge were it not for this advantage being in play. And combining that now with the knowledge that, okay, Ricard almost surely gets this necklace and is on to the final four. Even if he loses that final four immunity challenge, he's right around 50-50, just all things being equal, to make it through the fire portion of final four. And I am, at this point, not having heard anything to dispel me of this notion, under the impression that in any scenario where Ricard makes it to the final three, he is the winner of this game. So I feel like my main objection is just the ultimate gravity that this advantage had on the way things would go on to play out here. And there, I don't want to be mistaken as being someone who is even slightly upset about the fact that Erica won the game or won this challenge or anything along those lines. I've always been a big Erica fan. I'm very happy for her here, but it just seems very likely to me that this random Easter egg hunt ended up essentially being a $1 million Easter egg hunt. And that does not feel like what we came here to do.
Yeah, I do think also that if Ricard just makes it to the final four, then what we had in practice was Xander winning and taking Erica, I think, was the perfect underline for Erica's case for herself, that she was actually like the puppeteer of the season, but doing it from within the shadows, and Xander was just oblivious to that and ended up taking her. And that was like, that is the perfect proof that you can give, right? Of, I was the biggest threat at this stage two in the game, and I was just taken to the finals by someone who hadn't clocked that yet. Whereas if Ricard is there and Ricard is the biggest threat, then maybe Erica does still get taken, but that whole fact now is both different and overshadowed by, oh my god, we have to do something about Ricard. And if we don't, then whatever we do is irrelevant because Ricard's going to beat all of us. So maybe there's like a subtle impact there as well. Looking back at things like this in the past, so we had famously the Shaky the Clown challenge where Malcolm in Philippines, he gets like this preamble challenge where he wins that and gets an advantage in the actual final challenge. But that advantage is so redundant in the sense that if you're good at the challenge, you don't need it. And if you're bad at the challenge, it's not going to help you. And so that felt both in a way like much more directly impactful, but also pointless because like if it's not going to actually affect the outcome most of the time, why are we doing this? And so I think it's tough to strike a good balance with this kind of challenge power up, if you like, where, you know, it's either so game breaking that it does literally break the game, or it doesn't really do anything, and then you're just padding out time in the finale, essentially.
I think, or at least my guess would be, that whenever they did this with the Dream Team to practice and figure out what would be fair, they landed on this degree of helpfulness, for lack of a better term. Again, anyone who's good at synonyms, please find me on Twitter at Colin Stone, where I think the producers went in thinking, perhaps completely sincerely, this isn't going to be that big of a difference maker. And it's just because of the way things played out, where it was such a tight finish, that it came across on TV as like the defining reason why Erica won this necklace and Ricard did not. But yeah, I am happy to grant that when they were setting it up, they probably did not count on it playing this much of a role. But as with the Shaky the Clown challenge, the like pre-challenge challenge that Malcolm won in Philippines, and I'm pretty confident other similar things have been run that are not immediately coming to mind. I want to say like Terry Dietz won like a bed to sleep on the night before the final immunity challenge or somewhere around that point in Exile Island. And I would suspect other examples exist throughout history. I do think it's just like we have this hole, as far as we are concerned, in the schedule that we need to fill. And I personally would be questioning whether or not they need to fill it with some sort of challenge or Easter egg hunt in the first place. But I don't think it's that big of a deal, frankly, if whatever the advantage the person ends up winning isn't actually that much of an advantage. What they are really going for is just a segment. And that's why it feels so odd to me to have it impact the game to this extent.
Yeah, I wonder what the hope was when this was deposited into the game. Was it that maybe Ricard runs it and then the final five challenges even more of a formality, or is it someone else gets it and now Ricard actually has some serious competition but ends up winning that challenge anyway? Or is the hope secretly that that person does actually win the challenge and then there's a shot at Ricard? Like, I don't know what the desired outcome was necessarily.
I think the desired outcome is frankly like, let's not have this be too big of a difference maker. Like, I believe them that they didn't want this to be like some overwhelming advantage, the same way we have seen like advantages won in auctions in the past essentially be, here's a free immunity necklace or like a $500 immunity necklace. I don't think they want that, and with good reason as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think that with these actual players versus with the Dream Teamers, they necessarily got the result that they were hoping for or expecting there.
Mm-hmm. I also do wonder if this adds some context to those word associations that we try to read the tea leaves from in last week's episode, where for Erica, you had a few. There were like some strategics, and of course, I think a sneaky found its way in there because why wouldn't it? But at least half of them, I think three different people called her lucky. And so people were speculating of, does this refer to something that we've seen already, like the hourglass twist, where it seems like Erica went from being a likely target in the losing group to lock safe in the winning group? Or is there some yet to be seen event which is going to really impact how the end game plays out and work in Erica's favor? And this kind of is that potentially, although I don't know if that's what any of them are actually referring to.
I mean, this definitely is that for sure. And I would guess that this is partially what they were referring to. But I am a firm and vocal believer that luck is just a huge part of winning the game Survivor. And it's essentially impossible to win Survivor without getting lucky at least a couple of times along the way. And I, not to go into a whole diatribe on this, but like, just the starting team draw plays an enormous role on every single season that has ever run. And that's why I'm such a huge objector to the idea that, oh, whoever ends up winning the game was definitely the best player by definition and the deserving winner and so forth. Like, luck is an unavoidable piece of certainly modern Survivor, and I would say the entire history of Survivor. And I'm not trying to hold anything against Erica for getting lucky. That's just how it goes.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So for this final five round, Ricard now is vulnerable for the first time in a while. And it looks like for the last time ever, at least on this season, because as soon as you take, or as soon as you have a clear shot at Ricard, it seems like you kind of have to take it. And this is, if Erica's game had blown up, or if Ricard had, you know, won this challenge and then won just one of the last two rounds at Final Four, I think they would look back on that Final Seven round, right, where Ricard was actually eligible to be voted out, and Erica, as the swing vote there who could decide how that vote went, ended up voting for Liana. We could have looked back at that as the turning point of, this is when they had the shot and they all missed it. They let it slip through their fingers. And so, you know, now that Ricard is vulnerable, it feels like it's a done deal. He's going home. Although the show did a good job of actually convincing me that, oh my God, what if Xander does it? What if this is how? What if this is the big final game-breaking twist in the finale? Is Xander just like loses his mind and like woos Ricard like literally to $1 million? Like, well, it really felt somewhat plausible to me. But this is how I think this encapsulates the problem that a lot of people have had with the season of just, we don't see the relationships. And so, like, all of this Ferrari, which I'm sure we'll get into, of the Erica stands versus the Xander truthers, to me, maybe the best single argument you can make for Xander is Ricard, who said that, you know, he's naturally on his guard around, like, the young, straight, white guy. Well, that guy managed to become Uncle Xander, who, like, Ricard was just adored and had this really tight personal bond with. And we saw none of that until it became a convenient plot point at the 11th hour and the 59th minute. And so we just get, it just gets announced to us, essentially. And so even though that scene of, you know, Ricard saying, look, I'm about to be a father again, and I don't know if I'm going to be there for the birth, that was a powerful moment. But think how much more powerful that is if this is the final stage in this, you know, this beautiful bond which had blossomed over the course of the season, and this unlikely bond, and now Xander has Ricard's fate in his hands and really has this tough emotional decision to make. Like, that would have been such an amazing way to kick off this finale, and instead it's just we kind of speed run through all of that to set it up in a few minutes, and that really saps it of its momentum, I think.
I agree with that, and I think probably had Xander made the other decision and indeed idled Ricard here, we would have had more of a setup for that somewhere along the way to fill us in on that relationship if it were to become more meaningful in how the endgame played out there. But I too, Dominic, found myself watching this finale saying, I thought this was going to be a very straightforward Ricard boot, but oh my God, he might actually do it here. He meaning Xander, and it meaning idling Ricard. And furthermore, I don't think that would have been crazy. I know this is going to sound like
crazy.
both crazy and fully results oriented here. Like, seeing that Xander ended up getting zero votes in the finals is going to inform this take somewhat. But as I was watching this in real time, considering Xander still someone who could have some sway with the jury in a lot of timelines, I think in retrospect, there's virtually no doubt in my mind that if Xander had an accurate idea of his jury status, which I think he would be eager to admit he was very much overrating in the moment, to me, it's almost a no-brainer that you should idle Ricard here and keep him in the game just to leave the door open for you, meaning Xander, to then win the final four necklace and give it up and go take Ricard out in fire, because clearly anything short of that is not going to get you anywhere with the jury. And furthermore, I don't know that even doing that, like going full Chris Underwood, would have put Xander over the top with this jury. But as I was watching this in real time, I was thinking to myself, I don't believe that this would be the craziest thing in the world. If Xander had an accurate read on what the jury thought of him and thought of Erica and Ricard and so forth, I don't think he would even hesitate, knowing what he knows now, to go back and absolutely play his idol on Ricard here. I think that makes a ton of sense.
I think that's not going full Chris Underwood. It's going full Hannah Shapiro, you know, saving David Wright just for the sake of doing that to make a big move that you can point to. And I think it would go down exactly as well for him as it did for her. I think that once you're at the stage, and I get the impulse, because I think both Hannah and Xander here, by the time they get to this endgame, they're almost these tragic figures where they don't have the respect of the jury, and the time is running out to get it. But anything they do to try and earn that looks very transparently like exactly what it is. I'm trying to grab your attention and buy your respect by doing something which on the face of it makes no sense. But I'm just being different because I have to be, because if I make the obvious move when, you know, in one case, you know, Adam is also making the obvious move, and every other player, because it's an obvious move, is making the obvious move, then what do I have to distinguish myself? And so likewise here, if Xander goes rogue and idles Ricard to save him, and like, okay, you now have a move, but it's almost the opposite. It's a uniquely bad move that's on your resume, which let's say Xander does that and manages to best Ricard at Final Four. I think Ricard will stand up from the jury bench and be like, what the hell is wrong with you? You're like, you saved me. You gave me two more shots at beating you all for an easy $1 million. Like, what the hell were you thinking?
I think if I could have like perfect knowledge and be in Xander's spot here. And again, let me preface this by saying, I think Xander was dead before the ship even sank. Even if he did go ahead and do this, like, I don't think even this would have gotten him the win. But considering that failure to do this is essentially a guarantee that he's not going to win, I don't feel like it can really hurt. It doesn't matter to him necessarily whether it's Ricard who beats him in the finals or Erica or whoever. If he's purely looking for how do I increase any chance at getting first place equity here, I think the move is when Jeff at that final five vote says, if anyone has an idol or an advantage and you want to play it, now would be the time to do so. I think when you are giving Jeff the idol that you are now going to be using on Ricard, you at that point in time make it clear to the jury and to Jeff and to the others in the game, I am fully aware of how crazy this seems, but my plan is I have to beat Ricard in fire if I want any shot at winning this game. And so I am going to idle Ricard to make it.
But yeah, okay. But that makes so much more sense if it's Ricard is already in the final four because he won this challenge, because Erica didn't get this advantage that was thrust in at the last minute. And so now that we're in the final four, I, Xander, have won the final immunity. But then I can't risk Ricard beating someone else in fire, so I'm going to slay the dragon again once more myself. That gets you respect. Whereas if you keep Ricard around just so that you can hopefully, fingers crossed, beat him at a later stage, at that point you're doing kind of what Xander himself did. Think this, but you're wrong, and here's why. And that's just so tone deaf and it's so counterproductive. And I don't know. I feel like Xander, like you said, his game was basically over by this point, whether or not he realized that at the time. I think if he did this, that one move on the spot. I think like the idea of him getting any votes at all at that point is laughable.
And I see certainly what you were saying about like the Hannah Shapiro element of it, of even when he does announce his full intentions to the jury in the hypothetical where he's idling Ricard at final five, their reaction may be, dude, you are out of your mind and you should never even consider doing this, and you have lost my vote on the spot for even entertaining this idea. That's totally plausible. It just feels to me.
We saw Shan's, you know, visible reactions from the jury over the course of this like mid game and end game. Can you imagine what her face would have looked like if Xander announced he was idling Ricard? It would have been, I mean, that would have been the go to like a you know Reddit sidebar photo or reaction shot or whatever for the rest of time. Like you could not top that.
Yeah, and I do think, by the way, that it is a good comparison. The idea of keeping Ricard there, even if it opens the door for him to have a splashier resume in the timelines where he does make final tribal council, could be just viewed as so crazy on its face by the jury that it actually is completely counterproductive, and he's drawing even deader than he was in the timelines that we saw ultimately play out here, the same way that I think when he took Erica after winning the final four necklace, his plan was, not only, by the way, did he just have a bad read on what the jury thought of Erica, but I think his, at least part of his rationale was, by taking Erica, I'm going to signal to the jury that Erica is someone the players in the game aren't that nervous about, because to the players in the game, she hasn't done that much. And when the jury just flat out disagrees with that, it's never going to work. Like you need the jury. The jury's never going to be on that level. It seems like in that spot where you have the final four necklace, I think the considerations are either give it up and go into fire yourself, or you have to take the person that the jury views as like the biggest goat for sure, or you're just going to lose points no matter what level you're trying to be on.
Do we want to jump ahead to that final four performance then from Xander?
Sure. I mean, the only other thing, frankly, that I have before that is just kind of parting thoughts on Ricard. Should we go through, let's skip ahead to the final four decision since we're on kind of a Xander's point of view role here. And then we will go back through and talk through the players that we're going to lose along the way here. Yeah, Xander going to win this final four immunity necklace and end up keeping it and taking Erica. But let's first, Dom, talk about his decision to keep it in the first place, especially when he goes on to find out that Erica in particular, it seems like at least, is very bad at making fire herself. What did you think about this?
So I was wondering if this was set up for Erica is putting off some like sick bluff where she's pretending to be bad at fire so that Xander will take her and not risk her like going in and losing when she's his intended goat or something. But turns out I think Erica just, whether it's on that day or in general, just wasn't able to make the fire consistently. And so, you know, that had to inform Xander's choice. I think it's, once you make that choice, whatever reasoning you think you have for it, taking Erica, I think, just is digging your grave even further, right? And it's the perfect thing for her to point to as, hey, my strategy was to go under the radar and actually do still have a lot of influence, but let the big egos kind of collide and think that they're directing things, which is like the go-to line here. But Xander taking her would be a concrete example of that that she could point to, that she was kind of gifted by him at the last minute. But Xander keeping the necklace here, like, what is the idea that he should have treated Erica like she was the Ricard in this alternate timeline of, okay, well, it's not a case of I win and I get to the finals and now I'm counting my $1 million check. It's, this is one step of a two-step process. I have to be Erica twice, and it's, you know, one down, one to go.
I think, ironically, another part of his rationale for taking Erica was, I don't want her to have the possibility of winning the fire challenge being on her resume, when in reality, what he should have been concerned about being on her resume was her being able to point to, like, I was constantly underestimated and Xander took me, and that's exactly what I'm driving at this whole time. But yeah, no, I don't know what he was thinking necessarily about, like, even who his biggest threat was. If I gun to my head, I feel like, in real time, he probably was thinking Deshaun was the bigger threat to him, because just like what I'm essentially working backwards from is, how do you ever not take Heather? And I think the only way is if you are just not nearly as concerned about Erica as you need to be. And we see him voice repeatedly that the reaction he thought he was picking up on from the jury a couple of votes ago, when Deshaun was doing his whole truth bomb drama, was just wildly off base. And that, I think, ended up playing a defining role in a lot of Xander's decision making down the line here. So I don't think that whether he should or should have been thinking of Erica as like the new Ricard is even something going through his mind in this moment. I think he just, as we saw in a confessional, was thinking to himself, after this sort of end game kind of dominance, how do I not win? And obviously there are plenty of timelines, as it turns out, where he is not going to end up winning here. But I think he just had perhaps like a historically bad read on how the jury was feeling about the people left in the end.
Yeah, but if you go through that logic and you take Erica so that she can't add this final thing to her resume, and you hope that Deshaun loses a fire. Well, if Deshaun wins a fire, well, now he also has that that exclamation point at the very end. And if he was your biggest threat to begin with, well, now he's an even more formidable opponent. So if that is the reason you're using to keep someone out of fire or put them in fire, then it's kind of inescapable unless there is like exactly one person you care about as a threat and the other two are being written off. But if that's the case, then there's an inherent risk in taking that one threatening person with you and letting the other two battle it out for third place, essentially. So right. I think that's a dead end no matter how you slice it. I think the worst thing you can do is, once you have made this incorrect read, is to announce to the jury that how they feel about it is totally incorrect, and that actually you've seen the truth this whole time, and that Heather is she's not a goat after all, everyone. She's one of the biggest threats left in the game, and it's maybe this is some ill-advised attempt to like butter up someone who you think is going to lose fire and go to the jury. Although if that's the case, then Erica's there with you, and she's 100% voting for Erica, so whatever. Maybe it's trying to show the jury that you actually are understanding of other perspectives, and it's acknowledging someone who is getting written off, but then you're accusing the jury of writing that person off, so they're not going to be patting you on the back for being an empath. They're just going to be annoyed at you. So like, when people say they don't understand how Xander got zero votes, leaving aside some of the other events of the season, like if you sat someone down who maybe had not watched much Survivor before and you just had them watch this finale, I think they would understand completely how Xander got zero votes, because that whole charade is so mind-boggling that, like, of course this by itself, right? By that point, I think Xander was already in very dire straits. But it's a perfect summary of this larger, maybe lack of awareness that gets you to the point where you think that that's ever possibly a good idea.
Right, yeah. And for the record, as I'm guessing we will talk about whenever we get to Final Tribal Council, I think Xander may be a person who struggled as much as he did, or at least seemed to, on the TV version of Final Tribal Council, because when he showed up at Final Tribal, he went in thinking, I have a pretty good shot here, and it was quickly apparent to him that that was just not the case, and I totally understand why that would be, like, devastating in the moment to someone.
Well, so Xander, his version of events, as told in the exit interview, is that when he got to the Final Four Tribal, and he, you know, he's wearing the necklace, and the jury files in, he gives this smile to Ricard to just be like, hey, we did it, and just expecting that based on that friendship, which, so we're told, they had within the game, that Ricard would be really cheering him on and really pleased for him. And Ricard just gives him this icy glare, and it's like, oh shit, well, if that's the one person I thought I could count on, then what does that mean for the rest of them? And it's not just that. It's not just this one vote maybe is in another column. It's this is someone who you have to imagine is going to be a very influential voice in the jury house, and someone who is going to be a forceful advocate for whichever outcome he thinks he wants to happen, right? And so if it's just, you know, I pissed off Danny on my way out, and that wasn't a great idea, but okay, I lose Danny's vote. There are a few more to play with. If I piss off Ricard, or if I piss off Shan, well, that's bad news, right? I pissed off Evie, Tiffany. Actually, now that I think about it, all of them, maybe it's a bad idea to piss off. But once we extrapolate from that, but yeah, the way he told it was, that's when he really started to get this sinking feeling. But then also his mindset at every point before the Final Tribal was what you do in the run up to Final Tribal doesn't matter as much. It's how you sell it once you get there, which I think historically is not really the case. But if it is the case, that massively favors Erica, of all people, above anyone else, because the danger of that kind of under the radar game is the image you have to give in the game to be under the radar is of someone who is not really doing anything and not a real threat and not worth turning the spotlight on. And by the time you do need to put that spotlight on yourself at Final Tribal, maybe people's perceptions are locked in and it's too late to change their minds. And if you try and do it in the game, you try and like rip the mask off, well, now there's a chance for you to actually become a target at the end. Whereas that dynamic of just get to the end and then it's all up in the air, that is perfect for Erica, who her chiron says communications professional. And I was like, okay, what does that mean? Not least because every other person in Toronto is a communications professional of some kind. It turns out that Erica is like, her literal job description is the exact skill set you need for Final Tribal Council. And so, like, if that's the case, then taking Erica with you to the end seems like even more of a suicidal move than anything else, because it's like, well, you're taking someone who maybe you don't respect her right now, but if anyone can flip those perceptions of her at the final hurdle, it's Erica, more so than, honestly, 90% of contestants we've seen on the show before.
I will take the over on 90 for sure.
99. I mean, yeah, whatever.
Although, I do not feel like it was some stellar performance at Final Tribal Council that put her over the top. I think Erica was a slam dunk 100% winner. On night 25, before that, frankly, as soon as she got taken, though.
I always get thrown by the night 25 thing, because it's like, oh, that's the final eight round or whatever, but having to update our timelines there. But yeah, I think that is often the case where we talk about who gave the best Final Tribal performances, and often it's tough to judge because we don't actually see a decent chunk of Final Tribal. They often last for, 2 or 3 hours, according to all accounts that we've had on the show. And also, it's much easier to give a good Final Tribal when you don't need to give a good Final Tribal because you have the sympathy of the jury already. With all of that in mind, I would say Erica gave one of the most confident and self-assured Final Tribals that we've ever seen. And it's exactly the kind of performance which, if it was more up in the air going in, she would need to give to sway any votes that were on the fence. Right?
I think she smoked the other two at Final Tribal Council. But again, I think that was greatly aided by the other two being very clearly, as far as I was concerned, kind of grilled by the jury, whereas Ricard and Shan and others were, from my perspective, going way out of their way to lobby as hard as they could for Erica, and that's going to help anyone.
But I think that when Erica's literal job is preparing people for hostile questioning in interviews, then at that point it's safe-ish to guess that she would handle that well herself. Versus, I know this always comes up when it's like, well, you know, Cass is a lawyer, so, you know, she's going to give that courtroom confidence at Final Tribal. And I don't think the read across there is as direct as you think it is. Versus for Erica, like, this is, I mean, there is no better job to prepare you for that. And also personality-wise, she seems very good at, when she's picking her spots, when she does want to assert herself, she can do that, and in the face of that pressure. So if anything, Deshaun and Xander, when they were like dropping the ball there, they needed Erica in her day-to-day job there by their side to like coach them through that struggle.
Right, but I totally agree with that. Just larger point for me is, I don't think Final Tribal Council virtually ever matters at all. I will take way, way under 10%, probably under 5% of jury votes that have ever been cast being decided based on anything from Final Tribal Council. I think the overwhelming supermajority of jurors go into Final Tribal knowing with essentially 100% certainty who they are going to be voting for, no matter what gets said that night. But that is certainly not the point. Erica did absolutely crush that. Yeah.
Let's go back to the fire topic quickly, because this has become a talking point in this unpicking of the aftermath of this season. Is, with the way the show has evolved now, do you almost need to put yourself into fire in order to not be received poorly? Like, is that almost the default expectation at this point, that you will, after having won the necklace, which in all seasons past would have been the ultimate triumph, at the end of the game, do you then need to give that up? And it's like, okay, well, just kidding. Now this is the main event coming up here, and how you do in that ultimately determines not just who goes to the finals, but how those people are perceived when they get to the finals.
I'm glad you asked. I was listening to Dom Abate, a great friend of the podcast, Dom Abate over on RHAP, along with other friend of the podcast, Rob Cesternino, a week or two ago.
Love to have friends. You know?
Yeah, feels great. And this was a topic they got into in a lot of detail. And for obvious reasons, you know, Dom, I think, looks back on his time during Survivor 36, and probably his single biggest regret is not giving up the necklace and going into fire. And that's totally understandable. And that is something, you know, who better to be talking about this sort of thing with than Dom Abate. So not at all objecting to the conversation being had, but I actually believe, and it's not just because of that one podcast, I feel like this has been coming up over and over in recent seasons, at least, the idea of you almost have to give up the necklace and go win at Fire if you want the full amount of points from the jury. I think this is becoming very quickly one of the most overblown, overrated, whatever you want to call it, ideas permeating through the Survivor zeitgeist and gaining a lot of steam that I do not personally think is warranted. And again, I totally understand that in the case of Dom Abate or in Xander's case here or Natalie in season 40, all of them probably would have been better served giving up the necklace and going into Fire. However, if you look at the people who have actually been winning these seasons where the Fire Challenge is a thing, if we want to roll through them, Ben Driebergen, I think, very clearly did not need to go make Fire. He would have won just as easily had he just won the final immunity challenge instead. He got bailed out by the Fire, but I don't think it mattered at all whether he won the necklace and kept it or ended up winning in a Fire challenge. Wendell, I think, very conceivably could have still won if he had just won that final immunity challenge. I don't know this one conclusively either way. Obviously, that vote was very close, but I think it's a pretty big leap to say that if Dom had beaten Angela in Fire instead and still gone and faced Wendell in the final tribal council, I still could easily see Wendell winning that vote. And I think the reason that Dom Abate focuses so much on, oh, I should have given up the necklace, is because by giving up the necklace, I'm not going to be in Fire against Angela. I'm deliberately going against Wendell, and Wendell will not be there at final tribal council in any scenario where I am. And that's just an auto win for me. But the larger point here is I think Wendell certainly did not necessarily need Fire to win that season. Both Tommy on 39 and Erica this season were both taken. They didn't win the immunity necklace or the Fire challenge, and they won the game. And then I heard Michelle this past week on RHAP say very clearly, Tony would have won even without the Fire. If he just won that final immunity challenge, Tony is the winner of that season. And obviously Nick Wilson, by the way, did not make Fire and went on to win the game. I think we are literally looking at only Chris Underwood as a winner of a recent season who needed to go and give up the necklace and make Fire to win the game. And obviously those were like comically unprecedented circumstances where I'm happy to grant that in that exact situation, and Natalie was in a similar one, where you are out of the game on day some single digit number and you spend the whole time away from the actual political dynamics, yes, you do definitely need to give up the necklace and go make Fire there. But I am genuinely becoming like borderline tilted about how mainstream this talking point is becoming about like Fire is just a vital part of a winning resume. I feel like the history to this point does not map that out at all. And I think we are honestly getting closer to the point where someone will incorrectly give up the necklace and cost themselves the game, which I would love to see, by the way. Yeah. But for instance,
I would like nothing more. Yeah.
This season, Ricard certainly would not have needed to go in and make Fire. And obviously Erica did not need to go in and make Fire to win the game. I think this is one of the things that, frankly, like the general Survivor commentariat is the most wrong about in modern times. I do not believe it is anything close to the big deal that it is made out to be.
Yeah, you are becoming increasingly fire-pilled by the day, you know, just slowly stewing over there. But I think you're right. And I think the error here is mixing together two different things. So there's the case where you are yourself either the biggest threat or the second biggest threat, and you need to make sure that your strongest competition doesn't get to the finals. And the best way to do that maybe is to take matters into your own hands. If you think that, well, I don't trust these other people to make Fire and keep them out of there, I want this done right, I've got to do it myself, then maybe you have to give up the necklace and go in and try and beat them there. Or if you think that your odds going into whatever permutation are not that great, and you need this one final thing as like this last minute capstone on your resume, then maybe it also makes sense to, you know, if you can say, I won the final challenge, and then also I won the real final challenge, maybe that's enough to move the needle a little bit. But those are two very different incentives that people might face, and mixing those together for the sake of some like misleading statistic on, well, this is how many seasons we've had with fire, and this is how often the person who won the final challenge has won with that. Like, that's, I feel, I always, my hackles go up these days when people use those statistics like that without ever making their assumptions very clear, because there's always some follow-up question you need to ask, which just kind of brings the whole house of cards down, in my experience.
Right, yeah, and to clarify, again, I get why it is a regular point of discussion, especially when we go on to see Xander get no votes, Natalie lose in the finals, in a spot where, as crazy as it is to me, it very much seems like Boston Rob and company probably would have voted for her. As egregious as that decision would have been from purely my own narcissistic view, I believe Natalie very conceivably could have won Winners at War despite being voted out on literally day two if she had given up the necklace and then won the fire challenge. And obviously when Dom Abate is on the podcast and the fire comes up, that's going to be something that he looks back on with a great amount of regret as well. But I do not think it is nearly the big deal that it is made out to be these days in general.
If I was Dom Abate, of course it would weigh on my mind, because firstly, you don't really have the precedent to work with there. You are in fact one of the people helping to set the precedent and forming this assumption that people will be making and talking about years down the line. And then also, you have literally the closest final tribal outcome in the history of the show, to the point where it's decided by this unique tiebreaker. And so, of course, your mind is going to turn to, well, what if, or what could I have done differently for the rest of your, the rest of your days. But that's a unique situation. And assuming that everyone else is in the same situation, like, it's just going to lead you astray, I think.
I will further point out, Dom, along the lines of fire making, I have been, much to your dismay and something you've given me a hard time for many times over the years, I think the two things anyone who knows what they are doing must do to prepare to go on Survivor are, one, memorize as many of the puzzles as you can. That is a tried and true winning method for a lot of these challenges. And two, you must be at least competent, or at least have some sort of practice making fire. And I think Erica is a perfect illustration of how high the stakes can be on whether or not you can make fire. And yes, she did not need to go into the fire challenge. She was able to use her social abilities or whatever to coerce Xander into essentially punting. But I do not feel personally like relying on other people to punt is ever a good plan. However, if she were thrown into the fire challenge here, being able to make fire or not is literally worth $1 million to Erica. If she wins the fire challenge, she wins the game. If she loses the fire challenge, she does not. And she cannot reasonably expect anyone who has a clear grasp on what's going on in the situation to leave her out of that fire challenge. It felt horrible seeing one of my favorites on season 39, Lauren, show up to the final four just totally unable to make fire in a spot that easily could have been a $1 million tipping point for her. It is crazy to have no idea what you're doing on the penultimate day of the game as far as fire is concerned.
It is time to put our monies where our mouths are here. The same way that, you know, Christopher Hitchens eventually volunteered to be waterboarded and saw the error in his ways. It is time for you, Any loved ones in Colin's life, get him a fire making kit for Christmas. We can go out into the wilderness. Someone can bring a little camcorder, and we can really test our assumptions here on how difficult this is.
I am not someone who is about to go on Survivor. I do not have $1 million on the line here. If someone would like to put up $1 million for me to beat someone in a fire making challenge, you best fucking believe I'm going to be practicing that fire challenge.
Okay, but what if you were cast on Survivor for better or for worse, and then
you're
out there...
For worse, unambiguously for worse, if I'm cast on Survivor.
Yes, but you are out there, and you are you're putting the work in before you go out, and you're doing your best, and it turns out making fire is much harder than you've ever given it credit for. Like, what would it take to not lock into this mindset of, if you can't make fire out there, then you must be doing something wrong? Because we saw Heather, who... It seemed like on some level did know how to make fire, and she did make what seemed like it was going to be a winning fire. And then just, I don't know if it was like the rain or the wind, or maybe there was something she could have changed with the angle of her little base. I don't know what it was, but it feels like the idea of I'll just go in and I'll make fire and it's fine. That's not like, you know, the final four round is chess boxing, and you know, Magnus Carlsen is going to cast off the immunity necklace and go in there and take matters into his own hands. There is an element of variance and uncertainty here that does confound that. Like, if you think you are the prohibitive favorite to win the season, and you also think you're the best in fire, well, that's not 100% chance. It's like a... I don't even know what the number is, but it's not close to 100.
No, it's not. And we don't need to know the exact number to know that... Being proficient with just sparking a flame with flint is a massive equity tipping point. And I'm not trying to say I'd be 100% to win any fire challenge myself. I've never made fire with flint in my entire life. But as you know, Dom, I grew up in Maine. I grew up with a wood stove. I feel very, very comfortable in my ability to have a good structure for my fire if I get newspaper and matches, and that does translate at least somewhat, where when I was watching Deshaun and Heather and many, many, many others make fire over the years, it's not, again, not specific to just these two, but I look at those fire structures, it's like, oh my, I want to cry on their behalf, but like, you are totally smothering the life out of this. It's never going to catch if you put this much wood on this early. Point is, if I were to find myself being told, okay, you're going to go on Survivor, even fully acknowledging how unlikely it is that I would even make it to the final four in the first place, the easy number one thing I would spend the most time on as far as preparation was concerned is making fire with flint, like getting a spark with flint. There's no doubt in my mind.
That's going to be your personal backstory montage when you make it out there, is you just in the woods in Maine with your little wood stove, just you know, learning how to fend for yourself.
I am merely saying, Erica not knowing even the super basics of how to make a fire here could easily have cost her literally $1 million because she lives in Canada and doesn't have to pay taxes for whatever reason.
So I was thinking about this in the shower earlier. So when you look at the all-time money list, right? So it's going to be Tony at number one and then Sandra at number two. And I think those two spots are basically locked in, right? I don't think anyone else can really come close to those. And then you have, you know, Boston Rob's million from Redemption Island, his 100K from All Stars, and whatever, like, eye-gouging stipend he managed to negotiate for 39, or just as an appearance fee for 40. Between all of that, you know, combined body of work over close to 20 years, I imagine he's, like, in the mix for a top five or whatever, but Erica, just being Canadian, where she doesn't have to pay any taxes on her winnings there, you know, it's not 600,000 after Obama or Trudeau takes it. does she... Or automatically escape that, you know, 35-way tie or whatever for last place? Does she just become the third all-time money winner just by default?
I think that is probably true. I'm not a tax accountant personally, but I will now, with that in mind, say, number one, memorize the puzzles. Number two, practice fire. Number three, become a Canadian citizen. You're just leaving so much equity on the table
I'm
by
doing
remaining
my best,
American.
Okay? Doing my best.
Didn't you just wait? I feel like I just heard that you're now officially full-blown Canadian. What's going on?
Permanent resident, not citizen. But looking at the cast list for 42, which we know nothing about other than their names and their, you know, their town or whatever, and we're going to keep it that way. A lot of Canadians on this cast. We may, I think the Canadians are taking over here. But
is
in
being
any
Canadian
case,
overpowered on Survivor? I feel like a Canadian, I would take a random Canadian over a random American for sure.
Well, we had this discussion of Mormons who were like crushing it historically, and one of those Mormons was also a Canadian in Todd Herzog, who I guess half Canadian, if you want to be technical about it. But now that we have Todd and Erica on one side of the ledger, and I guess Tom Laidlaw or whatever his name was in the other, that's a pretty good hit rate in terms of Canadian success so far. So maybe there is something to that. But let's say, because Canadians are overpowered, what if Erica comes back and wins again? So even if she's only winning another $1 million instead of two, because, you know, COVID, times are tough, so on and so forth, would she actually earn more than Tony did?
Not more than Tony. I mean, Tony got $3 million.
Well,
like, then when you're getting like half of that taken out, she'd probably be pretty close.
so that's the next milestone to shoot for, I think.
Yeah. So what more, Dom, on this Final Four or fire in general, other than an apology to me for being so wrong all these years about the importance of fire, would you like to get out of the way on this wrap-up podcast?
I have no more comments to make about fire ever again for the rest of this show. And this show, I mean just this podcast for the rest that we continue to do it. I think that, so Erica being taken here by another eventual losing finalist, it continues the echoes of like the Tommy Sheehan story, right? Where it's a good proof that for Tommy, the idea of playing this very under-the-radar game is, I think, quite different when you're like this six-foot, God-knows-what guy in an endgame defined by the women, as opposed to, as Erica channeled with her like boardroom analogy, right, this is just who she is in her day-to-day life, is the kind of short, quiet woman in a room full of loud businessman. But either way, the similarities there kind of grow and grow, where it's someone who, I think, looking back and maybe looking at it just there in the moment, you should have been able to tell was the favorite to win there, just gets handed a seat in the finals, and I imagine gets to start spending their money mentally on day, you know, N-1 instead of when things are all said and done.
Yeah, and incidentally, just in terms of Erica potentially coming back and winning again and becoming the number one or number two, somewhere around there, all-time Survivor money winner. I don't know if this would come up at any point, so I'm just going to say it now. If Erica did come back to Survivor, I could actually see her doing really well again, even compared to some of the other people from this cast that I think would be excellent returnees, who I am not nearly as confident in as Erica, who would, of course, be going back as a known former winner. I actually feel like she'd be in pretty good shape to do a good job again.
Yeah, and I think that she would have a good reputation, because for as much as everyone on her cast was calling her sneaky left and right, what we saw on the screen didn't really bear that out. She wasn't going around like shanking her allies before they could do anything about it. It was a very almost honest game in one sense, right? It was playing from the bottom, and then because you're playing from the bottom, you don't really have to put yourself out there in that sense. And then once you're able to flip the script and kind of take control of the game at the end, at that point, the end game is in sight and everything is kind of locked in already. And it's, well, yeah, all we need to do now is we keep picking off, you know, Danny and Deshaun and Liana, or we at some point, one of us has to beat Ricardo in a challenge, but we'll get around to that eventually. And so there's no, to the extent that she had one like big signature move, it's not turning on her own ally. It's not doing anything which is going to mark her out to future competitors as, oh my God, we have to get Erica out of here before she can do any more damage.
So actually, weird question alert, but I think you're right that Erica played like an almost remarkably honest game for the most part. I'm sure she told plenty of lies or half-truths while she was out there, and obviously plenty of what she did not ultimately make the TV episodes here, but in the modern era of Survivor, where they're casting so many super fans and so many people who want to play really hard, obviously I don't think it is an actively good thing to be like burning eventual jurors, and I'm certainly not advocating for like lie as often as possible and backstab endlessly, but in hearing you set it up that way, it kind of crossed my mind, if Erica had gone into final tribal council, and again, even if she'd done this, I don't think it would have mattered. I think she would have run away with the vote either way. If a person were to go in to a final tribal council in modern times and try to make the case to the jury that what they should be rewarded for is playing an honest game, are we at the point where in this new era, and I think the same would be true at least for the last several years, if not much further before that, where playing an honest, straightforward game may actually be viewed as kind of a negative, like you didn't do enough? Or have we flipped the script that hard from like the Colby and Pagong kind of era of Survivor, where someone trying to argue that as a pro could actually be doing themselves a disservice?
So how do you mean? Like, where do you think that switch may have happened?
I think, for instance, a person who comes to mind for me would be our boy, Ken McNichol. Like, really took a lot of pride in playing an honest game and not lying to anyone. And I feel like that philosophy may have just been kind of rejected by modern Survivor casts.
I mean, I think it was rejected by Colby's cast. I think they didn't want anything to do with that.
It may have been rejected long ago, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was rejected maybe like midway through the first season by a lot of people.
But so I think it's absolutely like flatly rejected on its face. If you're, for instance, like a Coach Wade trying to preach honor, loyalty, integrity, when that's not even close to the actual approach that you ended up taking there, and it reads as hypocritical. But I mean someone honestly trying to play a straightforward game and then sincerely pitching that as like a pro in their favor, even in circumstances where that's exactly what they did and they set out accomplishing the mission that they were attempting to accomplish. I feel like the I'm just going to play an honest, loyal game may be more of a bad thing than a good thing.
Yeah, so I think the reason it fails is not just because there is a sense that this is a game where you're meant to lie and making moves usually involves betrayal or deception of some kind. But also the people who are making that case often are the ones who are not respected and who are actively seen as dishonest. And it's really hard to play the game in a way that you need to with any kind of difficulty to get to the finals and then also make the case and not be seen as a hypocrite once you get there. And so, yeah, I think Coach and Ken are bad people to make that argument, but it's kind of tough to be a good person to make that argument. But I think the way you can swing it to make it work, it's kind of the way that Cochran, in his final tribal council, I think his kind of genius twist was to make it about, well, I wasn't the best player on this axis or this axis because, you know, even if I say I'm the best challenge competitor, and he did win the most challenges of the season, implicitly that might be seen as undermining someone on the jury for whom being the challenge guy is my whole personality. Likewise, Cochran could say, just giving you a preview of your own arguments here, Cochran could say, I played the best strategic game, but then again, you know, are the Malcolms and so on the jury going to take too kindly to that? What he did was frame it as being all about timing, right? And so that's a great way to give yourself this unique selling point, but not in a way that directly competes with the self-image of anyone on the jury who wanted to be that person instead. And likewise, if you can say, look, I tried to be aware of my own strengths and my own position in the game, and what I saw was every time someone was double-dipping or they were playing too hard or they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar, they quickly got sent to the jury, and you can maybe point to the jury and give examples here. I took that to heart, and I realized what I'm going to do is be seen as like this honest, dependable vote, use that to embellish my image. And then when I do need to make a move, I have the reputation and the currency to do that. And so even if you don't end up making any of those moves, I think that's still a pretty compelling argument if you can make it in a compelling way, as someone like an Erica could do, in a way that someone like a Kane McNichol simply couldn't.
Yeah, I think all of that tracks. Dom, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here. Let's quickly roll back and talk through a couple of these people that we ended up losing before Final Tribal Council. I wanted to get just your parting thoughts on Ricard this season.
Loved him. Loved his twists and turns over the course of the season, from being in this this great power couple with Shan, and I am convinced, absolutely certain, we will see at least one, if not both of them, maybe on the same season together, as and when returning players finally work their way back into the mix here. He went from that to coming into the merge and being in this like very uncertain position, although in theory he could kind of bide his time as part of this big alliance, and then he ends up spearheading the flip on Shan in the biggest episode and the biggest move of the season, and then finds himself as the underdog, who, and maybe that like calls into question whether the timing of that move was right in the first place. But from that point, he then is the kind of unlikely challenge beast, right? Having to try and run the table in this home stretch just to make it to the end. And yeah, I found him a really compelling figure throughout every stage of that. And I feel like he had a more complicated journey than most contestants end up having. And he was a good character to witness at every stage of that.
Yeah, I found myself pretty quickly being a big Ricard fan during the early days. And when it's all said and done, I think Ricard may go down as one of my favorite players in the last several years. This guy is an excellent tactical player, an excellent character on the TV product. He knows what he's doing within the game and with the cameras, the perfect combination as far as I am concerned here. I thought he played a hell of a game, and in all likelihood, as far as I can tell, it just came down to a $1 million Easter egg hunt that prevented him from being a pretty big favorite to win if he made it through to that next round. Like, I'm just, based on how close that challenge at Final Five was, very confident that he gets that necklace if there is not a huge advantage to be had for someone else. And then once you get to that Final Four, he's going to have a meaningful chunk of equity to win that immunity challenge. And then even if he doesn't win that immunity challenge, he's still right around 50-50 to win the fire challenge there. And then I think he cleans up if he makes it to Final Tribal Council. So I think it was a lot of just bad luck for Ricard ultimately that cost him the game here. Now, at the same time, in the case of both Ricard and Shan, and probably some of the others, if not most of the others from this season that we may see back, to return to a previous point, even with any future returnee casts knowing that Erica is a former winner who already got $1 million from Survivor, I think the cat is more out of the bag as far as Ricard, Shan, maybe Evie, maybe Deshaun are concerned. Many of the Xander, many of the conceivable returnees from this season, I think I might take Erica over any of these people that she beat to do better on a second shot as well. Is that making sense to you, or am I underselling the extent to which being a former winner may matter?
Understanding it a little bit, but that may depend on how many other former winners there are. If it's the case that, it's Erica and 19 people who couldn't do what Erica did, then she's going to stand out by default. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a handful of winners, if it's some like game changer style scenario, where it's just whoever the hell is on the Rolodex and who picks up our calls, then maybe that's a different scenario. Who knows?
Yeah, just all things being equal, I think I would take Erica ahead of either of at least Ricard or Shan if they were to find themselves on the same season again in either a must-win format or a just-last-longer format. So there's at least some sort of silver lining, perhaps, to Erica being maybe a bit under-edited this season. More on that a little bit later. But I also wanted to say about Ricard before we close the book on him. First of all, I don't think Ricard would ever want to be the person who, as the late mid-game, early end-game is rolling around, stands out as the obvious number one physical threat and jury threat and possible social slash strategic threat in the game. I think he is someone who would, in a perfect world, never be that person, and I don't think he planned on being that person or wanted to be it until it got to that round of eight where, like, it just became clear through circumstances beyond his control his name makes a lot of sense to come up tonight. So he gets that necklace and then really has to turn on the afterburners from there, and came, again, I think one Easter egg hunt away from potentially running the table there through final eight to the end game. And I think Ricard,
it's not running the table in the sense that, like, they could have taken him out at final seven, right? Like, that's big true turning point for Erica too. If Erica doesn't win this season, then you don't have the whole, like, partisan feud between the Erica crowd and the Xander crowd. You don't have a lot of these attempts to retrospectively fill in the blanks with what they didn't show us from Erica's game. And then also, for discussions like ours, that it would center around stuff like, you know, that Lyanna decision over Ricard, right? Like, that would be one of the butterfly effect, what if forking points of the season.
For sure. Similar, like, Wendell at final six or whatever it was, probably should have had a shot taken at him there. Yeah, but running the table, maybe overstating it here, but I think Ricard and his kind of role within this end game is a very good illustration of something that I've been yelling about since the very first time we saw the fire challenge in season 35, where it ended up bailing Ben out. But we came in here on the podcast and said, okay, you want the fan favorites, for lack of a better term, and producer favorites, for perhaps a better term, to have more opportunity of just kind of brute forcing their way through in the end game in spots where historically they get taken out at final three in the early days or final four in more recent times. I think Ricard is a perfect illustration of what we talked about the very first time we saw this, which is producers, what you are doing is incentivizing the others in the game to take those people out even earlier than they otherwise would. Like, I think if Xander in particular didn't have to worry about a fire challenge at final four and could count on, okay, even if I idle Ricard here at final five, he'll be the obvious boot at final four, he would be a lot more inclined to leave Ricard in the game. And we see this all the time. And I think it's just going to get more extreme as long as these twists and Easter egg hunts and fire challenges remain a staple of the end game. I think Ricard is a perfect illustration of what we've been talking about for a long time, of, like, the producers in their efforts to give these sorts of players a better chance in the end game are only ramping up the incentive to take those players out even sooner than people ever otherwise would have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So loved having Ricard on this season. Would love to see him back someday. We will see what becomes of all of that. Dom, not entirely sure if I can say the same of our final four boot here. Heather, I don't believe she's probably going to be in the mix to be a returnee. Obviously, not someone who got a ton of screen time on this season, even though she ended up making it very far. All due respect to Heather, whatever the due amount is, I'm still, at the end of this season, like, my number one takeaway is, and I don't mean to be mean or whatever, but this is just the reality of the situation for me, is how did Heather get cast on this show? What were they going for in putting Heather on Survivor?
Well, especially as Tiffany, who brought this, like, amazing energy and so on to the season, was an alternate, right? And we saw her in her sequence in the premiere get that call, or maybe it was recreation of that call, more realistically. But the fact that Tiffany gets onto the show at the last minute and then is able to kind of make such a big impression compared to Heather, who was there for the entire thing and was always going to be on there, and yet we're still kind of scratching our heads as to why. I wonder if, cynically and without even knowing the exact details of just what it was that made everyone seem to resent Heather so much, I wonder if they were trying to set up this, oh, she's like the maybe slightly clueless older white southern lady on this amazingly new diverse cast, and there's going to be some conflict there. And I don't want to be that cynical, but part of me wonders what the other explanation could be.
Yeah, I had a similar thought as well, and I don't obviously know anything close to that to definitely be the case. And historically, you know, there have been arguments made that some people in the cast are more or less there because we're not going to need to focus on them, and we're going to be able to spread the screen time around to more of the kind of main characters within the season, and that may have had something to do with both Heather being cast and the way that she was presented on the show. But I feel like Heather, once she made the merge, barring being like idled out or advantaged out, whatever you want to call it, I actually feel like Heather ran pretty bad to not make it to the finals this season, as crazy as that's at. Like, I still can't believe that Heather had to do the fire challenge, that she was not obviously taken by whoever won final immunity.
Right. You would think, as Xander alluded to, that she would be the obvious goat to end all goes. And it sounds like it was actually a little more complicated than that, where Ricard, of all people, said that he would have considered voting for, or even been leaning towards, voting for Heather over Erica if the two of them had made it there together, despite liking Erica on a personal level much more, because he saw them as a power couple in the game, and the Heather was the more visible driving force of that. And I don't know if Heather actually would have had a shot. Like, I don't think Shannon Liana, for example, would have been as keen to, you know, get behind Heather as they were with Erica. But it's weird to think that she wouldn't have been the easiest, most obvious zero vote finalist of all time. It would actually have been a contest. And with that in mind, some parts of the season begin to fill out a little more. So when Erica, a few weeks ago, she had that seemingly inexplicable thing about, I need to either take out Heather or make a move to differentiate myself from Heather. It was like, well, wait, what? Excuse me? But I guess that's how that makes sense, if that truly is how they were being perceived.
So what you're saying is Heather was robbed?
Something like that, yeah.
Start the dialogue, Dom.
I'm sure there are people who, well, ironically, have that as a bit and then repeat it enough that they end up kind of actually believing it after a certain point.
Oh, if this was a season in like the early teens or whatever, there would still be people on Survivor Sucks talking about Heather being an all-time robbed goddess.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But yeah, it is an interesting dynamic to consider, especially when, and it's even more infuriating given that Erica herself identified Heather as one of the focal points of her game, and that we saw at Final Tribal, Erica said, I was playing a social game, but it wasn't by, I was the one forming super close bonds with absolutely everyone, and I also wasn't initiating the strategic conversations with absolutely everyone. Erica and Heather had this thing where if it made more sense for one of them to kind of lead the charge there, then that person would do it instead and like bring the other one along, or they could count on having this second vote coming along with them. And so if you remove Heather from the game, I think Erica still probably does pretty well for herself, but as she herself said, the style of her game would have to change. And so it's weird to think that despite being the most invisible person on the whole season and one of the least visible contestants still of all time, and hopefully you have an update for us on the statistics there.
Sure don't. I can quickly scroll and try to find one.
Despite all of that, it seems like she was actually a weirdly consequential player, given that her closest ally ended up winning the entire thing.
Oh, totally, yeah. The Heather and Erica pair, I would say, is like one of the defining features of this endgame, and we saw them, or more specifically, we saw Erica talk a lot at Final Tribal Council, and perhaps slightly before that as well, about how shocked she was that people were willing to leave them in the game together that long when they were such an obvious pair. I think this is just one of those situations, as most things pertaining to Heather are, that just did not make the TV episodes and was probably playing a much bigger role out there on the island in real time. It sounds like there's a pretty major disconnect between Heather on TV and the actual degree of influence she may have had and jury status she may have had that I don't think we can even begin to glean from her TV edit. And to quickly give an update along those lines, this data coming as usual from the great at Rob's Fact Checker on Twitter. I do have a final result here, Dominic, on where Heather lands on the purplest edits of all time. A fourth place finish for Heather has put her at number 14 in the most under-edited people in the history of Survivor. To quickly roll through some of the names near the top here, at number one, we wound up with, I assume this is through the duration of an entire season now. We've checked in on this sort of thing along the way, and it was always through X number of episodes. I'm assuming this means, this final chart means throughout. Number one, Chelsea from Ghost Island. Number two, Maine's Own, Zoe Xanadakis from Marquesas. Number three, Hope from Karamoan. Number four, Leaf. To then stop listing the numbers and just roll through it, the other people ahead of Heather are, in order, Whitney from South Pacific, JP from Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, Purple Kelly, somehow Courtney Yates, of all people, in Heroes vs. Wow. Villains, still one of the all-time injustices in the history of Survivor editing. We have Carter in Philippines, Dara, a fellow fourth-place finisher in Pearl Islands, Rancher Rick from South Pacific, Kelly Wigglesworth in Cambodia, and how about Liliana from Fiji? And that is the complete list of people in the history of Survivor who were more invisible, no matter where they finished in the game, than fourth placer Heather.
Yeah, Chelsea Townsend, number one on that list. Also, depending on who you ask, from the Ghost Island cast, like a subtly important piece on the game board in that season, too.
Yeah, and incidentally, Dom, your girl, Brenda Lowe, nowhere to be seen in this top 25 as the season is all said and done. So congratulations.
You love to not see it or not see her, I suppose.
Yeah. Another kind of tragic name to see on this list all the way down here at number 17. I never got the sense that this was like a particularly under-edited person when watching Micronesia. This is always someone who I can't get enough of and who always stands out to me every time I rewatch it. And perhaps a function of being gone so early and there just being so much returnee content to get to in like the early phases of that season. But at number 17, Chet from Micronesia, who I feel like is someone that most people who are familiar with that season definitely remember.
Yeah, a great example of how you can be remembered just as a character or for one particular moment, despite really not being there at all for everything else.
Yeah, next time we play No More Lockies, I'm going to try to find a way to play Chet. That guy deserves some more shout-outs. Yeah. Dom, okay, so let's, I guess, talk a little bit through Final Tribal Council, although at least for me, both the first time I was watching it and then obviously the second time I was rewatching it, I really had a hard time paying attention to what specifically was being said, just because it felt like such a foregone conclusion to me, which direction it was going to go. And Erica seemed to just be totally crushing it, while Xander and Deshaun both looked pretty awful for the most part here. But do you have any big highlights from Final Tribal Council or anything you wanted to touch on?
I don't know if there were any highlights that come to mind necessarily.
I guess a highlight is no more outwit, outplay, yes, outlast structure.
Yeah, thank God. And it's almost like that went out with a whimper rather than a bang. It was almost, we got into Final Tribal and, you know, 20% of the way through, I'm like, hold on, something feels different about this. And then I realized Jeff wasn't structuring it in the most ham-fisted way possible. And I was really grateful for that, honestly. It felt like it was more of a genuine discussion where people got to like say their piece and direct things in the way they wanted to. I still think that you know, the old format where you as an individual, you get up there, you say your piece, you ask your question if you want to, and you can make a name for yourself as a juror, for better or for worse, that does have its charm over the modern format. And like, I don't think it's a coincidence that it is really hard to identify memorable jury moments from Final Tribal from the last, what has it been now, 7, 8 seasons?
What are the memorable jury moments?
I don't even know what would be in contention. Like, what are the nominees for this award? I get why if you think it's obnoxious when someone does like the half Murphy or the full Murphy, just telling everyone else they're idiots for not voting for a certain player. Okay, well, yeah, that's a downside in that sense. But also, you don't get these big, memorable set piece speeches, which for a lot of players out there, that is what they're remembered for their Survivor season. It's what they do at the very last opportunity anyone has to exert agency over the game versus anything they were able to do in the game. And that's, I think that loss is a big one.
Absolutely, yeah. Very happy to be out of the outwit, outplay, outlast Jeff structures every conversation that gets had version of Final Tribal Council. Although I will say, well, I agree with you that it gives individual jurors a lot less opportunity to shine. And as someone who is a pretty firm believer that, like, very little that gets said at Tribal Council will actually end up being, like, tangibly meaningful. And I would, with that being kind of a reality as far as I'm concerned, would rather see an opportunity for the jury to shine. I do think, in the grand scheme, if Final Tribal Council did matter, I would like jurors to be able to chime in when they feel like they have something relevant to add to whatever point is being discussed, rather than only having their one chance and then they have to be silent for the rest of the time. I do think, like, more productive conversations can be had when it is more open-ended, but I also don't think it's pretty much ever going to actually matter. So with that in mind, I would rather go back to the old format, but I will gladly take this. I'm not here to be greedy about the way Final Tribal is structured. Just make Jeff as small of a role player as we possibly can and get rid of the outwit, outplay, outlast portion. Mission accomplished. Very satisfied with the way that this is looking now in this new era. So Dom, before we dive into Erica and final thoughts on her winning game, and I'm sure we're going to have plenty to say about the way that she was presented over the course of this season, let's not overlook the two losing finalists here. We are ultimately going to have a 7-1-0 vote. Shout out Xander for bailing me out of my zero vote finalist bet that I was definitely sweating very hard when I saw that Heather was not going to ultimately be a part of that. But let's start there, I guess, with Xander, who ultimately turns out to be, again, a zero vote finalist this season. I know one of the big talking points has been, at least as far as like the Facebook community is concerned, and frankly, as far as many of the casual fans that I talk to are concerned, is, oh my God, Xander was robbed. Dom, how robbed was Xander?
Friend of the show, Derek Lavassa, chiming in with that take as well.
What did he say? I missed this whole thing.
So this was on Twitter. Derek saying something like two challenges, scraped his way up from the bottom, kept his idol, so on and so forth. Like, the fact that he lost and got zero votes was a glitch in the Matrix or something. And then Ricard quote tweeted that and just like rebutted each point in turn and like really made this passionate case for Erica. So, I mean, Derek is the most egregious example because, firstly, it's exactly his kind of bullshit. Like, you know how these social games work. We can go check the tape on how many competitions you won versus Cody in BB16 or whatever. And then also just who won competitions on this season too. Like, Erica and Xander won the same number of immunities in the end. But anyway, this is the most aggravating part of, and inevitably it was going to be the most aggravating part of the season to me, was this off-season discourse now where it's turned into Xander was robbed versus actually, no, you don't understand how Survivor works. Erica deserved to win and play this amazing game. And as someone who now really has come around on Erica as a character and who was kind of lukewarmly pro-Xander for a while, like, I like both of them. I want to be able to appreciate both of them without it turning into this like sectarian conflict where I have to take one side and in doing so diminish the other person and try and make their game out to be less than it was. But it's so hard to just express an opinion about either of those two players outside of that context now. And that's really a shame. And it's I'm sure Erica is happily counting her million and something Canadian dollars now, but she doesn't want her win to be overshadowed by, actually Xander did this and this and this, and how did he not get a single vote? And I know it was, upsetting for her that early in the season, she was getting basically nothing in terms of on-screen content, to the point where she had this great TikTok about when there's a puzzle in the challenge and you get put on the puzzle and you know you're actually guaranteed some screen time because they have to show you, and she just looked overjoyed about that. But Xander he wasn't robbed. I don't think it's weird to say he did or didn't deserve to get zero votes, because proportionately divide up their votes in a certain way to, you deserve partial credit for this. So we'll deputize this person to go and vote for you, but the rest of us are going to give the arithmetically correct 6 out of 7 votes to this person. That's not how it works. And even though, I've come in here and said in the past, I probably would have thrown a pity vote to Dawn or something in Caramon, just given the way all of that played out. I don't know if Xander would want a pity vote if that's what it was meant to be. I don't think it's a consolation to get a vote on the basis that it might hurt your feelings if you got zero votes. I would want to vote because people want to vote for me. To be fair,
I don't think pity vote is the correct way of putting it, but the one vote that Deshaun got him substantially more prize money than Xander got if it had just been a clean sweep.
Yeah, and that certainly is relevant there. But so with Xander, if you look at his trajectory over the course of the season, you have that great moment at the merge, which was a collaborative effort, right? It required Evie, Tiffany, Xander all putting some amount of faith in each other. Let's give Xander the lion's share of the credit for that, for the sake of this. What else is there beyond that? So it's not really discrete moments. It's more a case of just the sheer fact he was able to go from fitting this obvious threat profile while on the bottom to just gliding his way through the game with a known idol that no one ever tried to flush. You have to read into that that's a pretty substantial achievement, which on the face of it is, unless he was kind of lacking in this other department so much that everyone had already mentally pigeonholed him as the guy I want to sit next to in the final three, and so there's no point in ever trying to vote him out. And so, if anything, if his name comes up, we're going to go out of our way to protect him, because that's what we have to do ourselves to have a shot in the game anymore. And so once that tipping point is reached, it's almost like the fact that Xander is able to coast by so effortlessly becomes a mark against him instead of a really good argument in his favor. And at that point, that's something that he has to recognize himself and do things to try and overturn. And that's why, the idea of this, do I save Ricard with my idol thing, or do I try and go into fire? I think that all would have been too little too late, but that would be an understandable consequence of this idea that, oh God, they really don't respect me at all, do they? And I've got to try and rescue this somehow. But it felt like, in one sense, this outcome was kind of inevitable. And so the idea that you couldn't see this coming is, well, either Xander is headed for a coronation on finale night and he's played one of the best games of all time, or people forget about him, he's part of the furniture, and you would think, based on that, he's headed for zero votes in the finals. And so even if you are in the pro Xander camp yourself, both of those outcomes should have been on the table. And so this, the one that actually happened here, and which maybe was always going to happen, should not have been remotely surprising if you have any idea how the show works.
Right. Yeah. And I do think, in retrospect, although I was not feeling this way because of the TV edit as we were watching this week by week here, I think a lot of him being able to sit on that idol for as long as he did came down to the eventual jurors, just not being nearly as worried about Xander as it seemed like, again, just because of the way he was edited, they probably would have been, if that were accurate to his actual the way he was perceived out there on the island. I think a lot of it was chalked up to, well, if Xander keeps his idol, that's fine. I want him to stay in the game because I'm not worried about him long term. And obviously, when those are then the people who are casting their votes for the eventual winner, I do think it's kind of a mark against him that he ultimately never faced any kind of heat and had to use his idol in some sort of spectacular way. Yeah. So I think a lot of it really just comes down to the way he was presented to the audience is perhaps a lot like Heather in the opposite direction, just not accurate to the way that he was viewed out there on the show. And I will certainly have more to say about this from like the opposite perspective when we talk through Erica's edit. But as far as Xander is concerned, while it is inevitably going to come with a noticeable, if not sizable, percentage of the audience being frustrated, mad, outraged, whatever, about their favorite, the Golden Boy, not getting any votes in the finals or even just anything short of winning, I'm sure would have upset many, many people who are big fans of this show. To me, I would consider Xander getting the edit that he got while going on to receive zero votes a very good thing in general. I love, maybe more than anything else from this entire season, that we got to go into this finale with the eventual winner not only just up in the air, but as far as I was concerned, as far as you were concerned, as far as I feel like many, many people were concerned, it was like a 3 or 4 way coin flip, depending on who you asked. And I would, if I were editing a season of Survivor, want that to be the case every single time. Like if I were a Survivor editor, I would not be working backwards from who is the eventual winner and how do we justify that story and make the casuals happy on finale night. I would, the place that I would want to start with the storytelling and work backwards from is how do we make this a multi-way kind of toss-up entering the finale. I think that is the number one thing I want going into any Survivor finale, is multiple people, more than, ideally more than two, but I'll take just two if that's how it's going to be sometimes. But I loved, and it was such a welcome change compared to literally any season I had watched since Borneo, to have this many very easily conceivable winner candidates entering a finale. And if it comes at the cost of a certain percentage of the less hardcore fans who are obviously just going to keep tuning in anyway, no matter how it goes, being upset until they forget entirely about Xander like 2 weeks from now, that's a price I'm very willing to pay.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be some, like, it's like the thing from The Simpsons where, like, the new Malibu Stacy equivalent gets released and everyone just throws out their old dolls and immediately, like, rushes the store to get the new one. And it's like, yeah, Xander can enjoy his 15 minutes now because, I mean, looking at the season 42 cast, just at their pictures, I don't see a new Xander or a new Ozzy or Joe or whoever just yet, but they'll give it time, you know, and once the pictures for the 43 cast roll around, well, maybe it'll be a different story. But I think you can make a case that the story this season was kind of handed off between different people. So initially, it seemed to, certainly to us and also to most people, like, well, this is the story of how Shan won in one of the most dominant games of all time. And then it was like, in very hushed tones, wait, what if this is the story of how Shan lost? Like, perish the thought, but what if? And that very quickly became the story of how Shan lost. And then once Shan did lose, well, now we have to find a new story. And Deshaun almost steps up to the plate as the main character here. And it feels like the his arc from being part of the flip on Shan to then being this power player, but imploding all at once at the same time, that was then the focus for the next few episodes. And then in the finale, Xander really became like the main character at the end. And I like when we got that personal content montage of Xander, I was thinking, well, shit, maybe this is actually, this was what it was in front of us the whole time. And this is going to be his amazing late run to the title. But it seemed like ultimately it was the story too of how Xander lost. And how accurate that was, you can debate. And you can also ask, like, is it really ever fair for the season to have like three or four distinct stories and for none of them to explicitly involve the winner in any way. I guess we'll circle back to that in a second. But it seemed very much like it was the story of how, even if in practice the game was decided well before this point, I don't think you can watch the finale here and not see why Xander lost, even if it's kind of working backwards to these were the factors the whole time, why Xander wasn't the threat that maybe he seemed to be.
Right, yeah. And I mean, I think Erica also emerged as kind of a major story very near the end, and she obviously had the whole thing with the hourglass prior to that. Probably could have done with a little more Erica over the course of this season, if I'm being fully honest here, as I think a lot of people are on board with. But yeah, Xander getting the kind of treatment that he got, even while knowing that it was going to end up with him just being a zero vote finalist, I understand that some blowback from a decent percentage of the audience is going to be, like, in order is the wrong way of putting it. I wouldn't be getting too worked up about it, no matter who I am here. But I get why that is happening. But again, I am grateful that they let us believe in Xander for as long as they did. I thought he was a really good player for the most part, although it seems like far fewer people out there actually playing with him tended to agree with that than I had been feeling like over the course of the season. But he is another person that I feel like will probably at least be in the mix to come back later, once he's more than 20 years old. I think this experience and just the passing of time could do Xander 2.0 and perhaps beyond that a lot of favors there, although he may be another person where the cat is kind of out of the bag. And if anything, actually, Dom, Xander getting zero votes in the finals here may be the best thing he could have hoped for. Like, if he's never realistically in the mix to win, but is very realistically in the mix to play again on at least one season in the future, the single best thing he could have going for him is, I didn't get any votes in the final the last time. Everyone thought that I was a big threat, but clearly that didn't pan out. This could be low-key a great thing for Xander.
Yeah, I think if you want to say Xander was robbed, he was robbed of the relationships which he did build on the show, right? Like, we saw the thing with Ricard. It would be easy to write off Xander in the light of him getting zero votes as, oh, he was just like this ditzy kid who was too young or too kind of distant to really bond with people. No, it turns out he was perfectly capable of forming these really deep connections with people out there, and I guess he didn't have enough of them for that to convert into anything. But, like, I think he does have a certain, like, wisdom about him, and I think he's handled his loss incredibly gracefully, from everything I can tell, and I think he will be a force to be reckoned with if he does come back in a few years' time. But yeah, I think that, as so often with these things, the idea that, like, this person, you know, should have won and was incredibly robbed and so on, it almost, like, puts them up on a pedestal and also diminishes certain important things about them at the same time. It's a very, like, incomplete picture there.
For sure. Yeah. So how about Deshaun, Dom? A name that hasn't come up too much over the course of this podcast, but was certainly a major player and big presence on this season overall. Final thoughts on Deshaun here, now seeing him as a losing finalist.
I love Deshaun as a character. I think you want people like him on every season where they are playing hard and they're playing, like, openly with their heart on their sleeve, but also in a very messy way where inevitably it would all blow up in their face. And you really cannot ask for too much more than that for me. And that's part of why this season and that alliance that Deshaun was a part of was so fascinating to watch unravel, because you could argue Deshaun, Ricard, and Shan, and maybe even Liana, were all players like that to some extent, right? And so for the contestants other than Ricard, they had this, like, larger cause that was uniting them until it didn't. But just all of them individually shared that quality, which made them, like, great TV and also great additions to just the context of what was going on in the game too.
Totally. Yeah. I absolutely loved Deshaun the whole time this season, clearly playing very hard, amazing presence for, in front of the TV camera out there, shooting whatever shots he could shoot, lying straight to people's faces, being hilarious. Would love to see Deshaun back on a future season. And again, another person that I am so happy they let me keep my hopes up for as long as they did, instead of trying to sow the seeds earlier that maybe if this guy gets to a jury vote, it's not going to go so well for him. I loved that I was able to keep hope alive as far as Deshaun was concerned for as long as I was able to. And I will acknowledge, like, pretty early on in this finale, it felt like kind of a foregone conclusion to me. After the first 20-30 minutes or so, it was like, okay, Eric is gonna win, and that's just how it's gonna go. And I was kind of, as I was watching it in real time, like, bummed out. Not that Erica, not at all bummed out that Erica was going to be the eventual winner, but bummed out that the suspense felt like it was gone for me. But then it crossed my mind, like, the vast majority of the time, that suspense would have been gone 2 or 3 months ago at this point. And I understand that at a certain point, you're going to have to start showing the casual audience, hey, here's the winner, and this is why you should be happy for them. And it took me a little while to bear that in mind as I was watching this finale. And I was kind of not losing interest or losing focus or whatever, but some air came out of my sails that had previously been there, you know, the week before when we were talking about it being pretty much a dead heat in our view between Erica, Ricard, and Deshaun. But another just reminder to me of how much better this show is when there is that kind of genuine suspense. And I have been an advocate for many, many years that, like, you literally can make someone invisible up until the finale and then get everyone on board with that person over the course of the 2 hours. Obviously, they did not get everyone on board with Erica here, but there is inevitably going to come a time where the edit has to start tipping plenty about the way that it is going to go. And while it was kind of deflating for me in the moment, again, not because it was specifically Erica, no matter which way it went, as soon as it became kind of clear who the eventual winner was, I was going to have that same sort of feeling no matter who that person ended up being. But another fond reminder for me now in retrospect of the amount of time I got to enjoy rooting for Deshaun, believing that he had just as good a chance as pretty much anyone else in the game. I thought Deshaun was an absolute home run from pillar to post here.
Yeah.
All right. So Dominic, let's now do it. Let's get into it. By a vote of 7-1-0, our winner of Survivor 41, Canada's own Erica. Dom, what are your just kind of major takeaways of things Erica did really well based on, again, what we got to see on TV and how this ultimately went her way?
So here's an idea that I'm workshopping. So tell me what you think. Erica is the Chris Underwood of Modern Survivor.
Go on.
Well, just in the sense that, like, the game, which already just calendar-wise was abbreviated, Erica just, by virtue of her tribe winning so much, and they did not get sick of winning, as it turned out, you know, the game starts in one sense for her, like, kind of halfway through, and then she doesn't have that much ability to affect it herself until this golden opportunity comes along for the flip on Shan, which she's able to be a part of and help to kind of grease the wheels for. And then overnight it becomes, well, suddenly I'm in the majority and the end game is already in sight. We're already at the point where these final three, final four deals start to get locked in, and you can imagine who's going to be in those final few seats. And we just kind of, like, accelerate through that portion of the game as well. And so for someone who, I think the virtue of her playstyle normally is when the game is a marathon and not a sprint, she's never going to, like, go out too fast and get tired and then get caught. She almost didn't have to test that bit because she, like, the entire, like, setting of the game was much shorter than it would be normally.
Sure. Okay. I don't know. Okay. I'm going to begin by saying I love where your head is at in terms of throwing out Erica is the Chris Underwood of modern Survivor. I almost asked you to stop elaborating on that because I just love the enthusiasm for the fire takes just on its face there. I see what you are driving at, and I don't know that Chris Underwood necessarily would have been the first name that came to mind to me for me along those lines, but I certainly appreciate the effort, if nothing else there. Dom, I feel like Erica is a very good illustration, and credit to Michelle Fitzgerald this past week on RHAP for laying this out, of something we have certainly talked about since the inception of this podcast 10 years ago, as far as just like general Survivor theory is concerned. And I think Erica may have even talked a bit about this in her own kind of exit press, although I'm not 100% sure, if I'm being honest. Being a kind of medium threat, just perpetually not being the big glaring target and also not falling so far behind the pack that you're never able to get any kind of credit or momentum near the end game. This is something we certainly were very complimentary of Adam Klein in Millennials versus Gen X for like crafting his whole end game plan around never being the biggest threat, but also never being the person who's just not going to get any kind of credit. I think this is as fundamentally sound as like Survivor theory gets, is having the targets that no one else can afford to keep around in that end game, in this case, Ricard, and furthermore, not being so far behind the pack that the jury's just unwilling to consider the prospect of you having done enough to ultimately come away with their votes there. I think Erica is a very good illustration of mitigating threat level. And for my money, that is what I'm looking for in a good Survivor player. Now, I think, again, a lot of her win, although not like an overwhelming amount, but certainly there was a very noticeable degree of luck involved in many steps along the way here. And to repeat something we talked about almost 2 hours ago at this point, I think that's just unavoidable. Every winner in the history of Survivor has gotten way luckier than I think we could even know based on the way that they are generally presented on TV. I am not deducting any points from Erica for running good in a game of Survivor. That's going to happen. As far as what she was able to control and the relationships she was able to form, again, we didn't get to see as much as we probably would have liked to from Erica, and I'm sure that more along these lines is going to come out as the exit press and deep dives on RHAP and elsewhere, not here, but elsewhere, continue. I think we're going to be able to appreciate Erica's game more once we can actually hear in longer form about it from her and from others. But as far as I'm concerned, I have a hard time finding places to make deductions against the game that Erica played, other than, of course, not being able to make fire at Final Four. I think that is the only glaring hole that I can point out.
Yeah, so I think the instance of luck, which maybe was what the other contestants meant by lucky, and this is the thing that I imagine the discussion will keep coming back to as it continues during the offseason, is the merge twist where Erica, she breaks the hourglass and she changes the course of history, which is funny that even though this is, in theory, it could be the thing that saved Erica and gave her new life in the game, it's amazing how much of a footnote that twist is in both her game and the season as a whole, even though it was sold as this like revolutionary event that we've never seen anything like on Survivor before. It's like, again, no one is watching for that. That is not the point. Maybe there are some lessons to impart from that whole experience. But you can look at it on one level and say, you know, we were told that Erica was going to be a target before that point, and when we get to the merge, she would have been a possible target in a much smaller pool of people you can vote for. And she goes from that to being safe and in the majority and so on. And so on one level, that is lucky. At the same time, the whole twist involved, I mean, firstly, the twist itself is like this unique aberration inflicted on the game, which, you know, if you put that in any other Survivor season, maybe you could change the outcome there too. But also, Erica's role in it involved being sent away to her own personal exile island for 2 days and not able to interact with anyone at camp, not able to double down on existing relationships or form new ones with the people who have just been added to the tribe and who everyone else is meeting for the first time. So I think it's really hard to say conclusively what would happen if Erica was back at camp and able to see where the winds were blowing there. And that is one thing I'm keen to hear as the deep dive start rolling in, is like, what did it seem like was going to happen before that twist, and then what might have happened after that twist? But almost regardless of that, I think it's hard to hold too much of that against her. And then past that point, I think Erica was never going to be in the position where single-handedly she was going to flip the entire game on its head. It was always going to involve these other quite active, self-motivated players being part of that and recognizing their own role there. And what she had to do was be a useful ally for them, someone they felt like they could work with and count on, and that they would have something further beyond that vote. And compared to like Deshaun and Xander and so on, what she needed to do was like not drop the ball, and she didn't drop the ball, and that's what she needed to do, and she understood the assignment, and she was able to pull it off.
Absolutely, yes. So Dom, let's now get into a big time point of contention, and I think very justifiably so. Erica is our eventual winner of this season, and over the course of these last few months, we have in general been very complimentary of the way that Survivor 41 was edited. What did you think about the fact that... I certainly felt very good about the way that it... Other than when it seemed like Shan was just about to run away with it, which was, to be fair, like a solid month or so of the season. In retrospect, like once I saw Shan go out and Evie go out, and they were like the two big pre-merge mega front runners, as far as I was concerned, and to have neither of them even make it to Final 7 was like an all-time breath of editing fresh air for me. And I do, in general, have a lot of very positive thoughts overall on the way that this season was edited. You know, we began this podcast saying we have kind of complicated or mixed feelings about the way this ultimately played out. And for me, that is entirely because of the way that Erica was presented on this season, our eventual winner, who, again, I am eternally grateful that we did not just have it forced down our throats, and that we were able to believe in as many decoy winners as we were for as long as we were able to do this. Once more, this would be exactly what I would want from every single season of Survivor, is keep as many people in the potential winner mix and not have any kind of glaring front runner out of that whole pack for as long as we can possibly maintain that kind of dynamic. But, and this is a big but, Dom, when it is the context of Survivor 41, and we have had six straight men win this show who have left a trend that has left, I know, at least a large and vocal chunk of the superfan viewing community very upset about the direction that the show, both in design and in storytelling, has taken over the last many, many years at this point. Given all of those contextual considerations, while I am extremely grateful in general for a lot of the editing kind of updates that they made this season, you know, we were in here last week or so talking about how I'm rooting for Erica on a personal level. I would love to see Erica win, would love to see a woman win for the first time in a long time, and it certainly doesn't seem like that person is going to be Heather, but also kind of rooting against Erica, not because of anything she has done, but because I don't know if I want to live in a world where for the first time since whatever it would have been, like 2016, 2017, somewhere in there, we finally have a woman win Survivor again, and this is what they end up doing with her. Like, that would be a very dark timeline for my money, and so I'm very conflicted about those two schools of thought, is the wrong way of putting it. Like, I am on the whole, if this were any other point in Survivor history, more excited about the way this season's story was presented than I would be about the overwhelming majority of seasons in the history of Survivor. But given that this is the first woman winner in so long, to get historically little from that person is a very odd kind of circle to square.
So when we came in here last week and we were looking ahead to this finale and making our very ill-fated predictions, part of what we said was we get what is there for Erica. We see why people are zoning in on her as a contender, but if she were your winner, it would be such a disservice to her and to the show for there to just be nothing,
right.
So little in for so much of the early phase of the game. And maybe it is an explicit shift towards all the matters, maybe kind of what Xander was alluding to too. It's like, in editing terms, it doesn't really matter what happens until you get to the end, because that's the thing that people focus on. If that's the case, I don't think it is the case, first of all, but it also presents you with this kind of impossible storytelling challenge when you are compiling a show which has, you know, 13, 14 episodes, and you there needs to be some kind of continuity between all of that. But in that episode, I tried to kind of present the theory for why maybe it's not just them falling asleep at the wheel, it is maybe them taking a bad hand and then still playing it suboptimally. And so I think there are two things that go into that. The first would be, firstly, it's harder to show that kind of social, more subtle gameplay where you're trying to stay under the radar than someone who is leading for the front and being very braggadocious and making these like big discreet moves. But that is a common play style that often does win the show, and it's a legitimate one, and it's been 40 seasons now, so figure it out. You know, if you can't find a way to show that in a compelling thing, that's on you, I'm afraid, at this point. Like, you that is just part of the job description. So the more contingent thing about this season is, what if your winner comes from a tribe which just doesn't have to do anything for the first half of the season? And we've come kind of like close to this before. We did have this with Michelle in Koh Rong, where they found a way somehow to just insert her at every point of the season anyway. But larger than that, you have this issue where it's not just Erica, it's the entire endgame, because four out of your final six, including Erica herself, your winner, Erica's closest relationship in the game and the most important companion for her in the game, is one of the least visible contestants of all time. You have Danny and Deshaun, who are this big power couple in their own right, two big characters, in Danny's case at least, like this very popular, lovable character, and then Deshaun as the main character who's kind of imploding towards the end. That's a story that has to be told. And then connecting those threads, apparently Deshaun and Erica were a lot more involved with each other than we ever saw on the screen. And that's why, you know, when Deshaun drops his truth bomb, it's not just what it seems like from what we saw, which is, oh, really? That's all you got? And it's just like a deflating balloon. It was actually, firstly, a lot more than that. It was a much more personal, much heavier barrage of attacks at Erica that, from what I hear, like, cause some bad blood after the fact. But it came out of a place of betrayal. It was like, we thought we had this thing going, and the two of us have been on and off and had this weird, complicated thing this whole time that we saw nothing of at all at any point. And so that whole thread just gets snipped off abruptly because we can't go anywhere with that. Erica and Heather, right? We hear nothing about the relationship that undergirded this whole season until, what was it, episode 10? The fact that like the two of them were even aware of each other's existence until that point. And so, again, when the idea is mooted that Erica is going to turn on Heather, or that Heather's going to turn on Erica, like, well, why do we care? Like, that the idea that there was something to turn on in the first place, it just is coming out of nowhere. It's news to us. And it goes beyond that, too. So you try and fill in that gap by saying, well, maybe there is some weird mystery going on with Heather where they don't feel like they can show her, and everything else is an attempt to work around that. But we saw with Ricard and Xander, right, this amazing relationship which, like, gets dropped on us like this kind of like it's like you've ordered some court documents and they just dump the entire case file on you, you know, a day before trial, and you never get a chance to read any of it properly or process any of it. It's just, you know, figure out what you can. It speaks to a larger problem in just conveying relationships properly on the show Survivor, as opposed to Heather did something uniquely bad, which we can't even, it's so bad that we can't even mention it by name, and so we're just having to work around it. Clearly that's not a valid excuse, because it's just applying to other things going on in the season at the same time. And so clearly the ball is being dropped somewhere in there. But on top of that, they've made it impossible to actually tell the winner's story in any kind of coherent way, because the maxim, as always, is show, not tell. And even though it's harder to show that kind of more social gameplay, and like there's not as much strategizing to show, firstly because it's 26 days instead of 39, and because we don't have to strategize, because we don't have tribal council tonight, because all we do is win. Despite all of that, you can show like fun conversations happening at camp, or you can show stuff going on despite all of that. Because instead, what happens is Erica tells us, and this is all we get from Erica for half the season, I'm gonna pretend to be a lamb, not a lion, and they're never gonna see me coming. Okay, great, but everyone on every season of Survivor thinks they're gonna be underestimated, and only a few of them can be right, and for most of them, maybe it's correct for people not to take them seriously or to estimate them at all, because they flop, they don't end up going anywhere. So either we can't read anything into that, or we can, but then it becomes the worst tell of all time, because the mere fact that Erica is on screen telling us that she's going to be underestimated is the most glaring siren of all that you can imagine, that she's going to go on and win, like Michelle style, right? And that's not a good outcome either. So that leaves you in an impossible spot. And then instead, what you have to do, if you can't show what Erica is doing that is, you know, on like a social level, or I guess what you do is you show other people saying that she's like sneaky, which is a kind of loaded term, but also one which doesn't seem justified, because we never see her doing anything. And that in turn undermines the exact case that Erica is making for how she won the game. Because if anything, from what we saw, she wasn't underestimated the entire time. She was being like framed for stuff that she wasn't even doing yet. It's like, well, how are you meant to make sense of any of that if you just don't give us anything to hang our hat on? I saw someone on Reddit expressed this very well, as saying it's almost like you're reading this book or whatever, you're seeing this story being told, but all of these crucial plot points are left out, and it's, oh, well, if you had just gone and read the author's blog where they explain this in detail, it's like, I shouldn't have to do that. That's not how the medium works. You actually have to, you know, fulfill your part of the bargain here.
Right, yeah, and I agree with all of that. I think it's admittedly a very tricky situation for the editors when the eventual winner and so many of the eventual endgame players are on the team that literally run the table in pre-merge challenges. That is a throw your hands up in the air and try to figure something out, because this is not going to be fun or easy either way in trying to present.
To be clear, I don't envy their position in having to do that, but like that is the job, you know.
Of course.
You've got to do it somehow. And so, hey, I love Shan as a character. We don't need Shan as the eighth place finisher to have like whatever, like a 160% confessional count of the next person. Maybe it can be 154 instead, and we can give like a tiny morsel of that to anyone on Luvu just to help enlighten that further. And what little Luvu we did get was mostly Nasir and Sydney, who I'm glad we got to see stuff from each of those. I think they really helped to be part of the ensemble of the season. But those are the two Luvus who played no long-term role in the end game of the season. And so if you are limiting yourself in how much you can show Luvu, then it almost, I think, something has to give. But that should be, maybe it should have to be Nasir and Sydney, because like you got to do more with the people who are going to be on the screen until the very end.
I had this same takeaway I think you were just alluding to, which is, as much as I absolutely love that they were willing to just put Shan front and center for as long as they did and give us, like, for my money, an all-time decoy coronation edit, I think that would be the spot where I would say, let's maybe cut back on some of the Shan content. Let's put her, instead of 7 confessionals this week, let's knock that down to 4 or 5 and open up 90 seconds or whatever to show the blue team a little bit here. Again, I'm just so torn about this because I love how in so many ways the edit of season 41 really flipped kind of conventional wisdom, or at least as far as I would be concerned, conventional wisdom in reading the edit on its head. And that is something I am always rooting for, is to be blindsided myself by the way that things are being presented along the way. At the same time, I still feel like there is a bunch of room for improvement. And to clarify, I feel like if this were Survivor 42 and we had just seen Erica win the previous season and we were not on this literal years and years long drought of having a woman win Survivor, it would be a completely different story for me. I would be way more forgiving, and I am very nervous that, not that the editors are like listening to this and taking notes, oh, what do Dom and Colin want to see and how do we best suit them going
forward?
Why
not?
They should. No, of course they should, but they're just not. Yeah. But I don't want this to be like mistaken, not by the editors, but by the listeners, of me now arguing, now that we've finally gotten a pretty under the radar winner, like, oh my God, why aren't you showing us more of the winner? Because that is not what I'm saying at all. I love in general the idea in virtually any other context in the history of Survivor for this to be the way that so many of the eventually very important players are presented early on. I love that the two big pre-merge standouts for my money were not there in the end game, because it would have felt like such a foregone conclusion to me. I love being blindsided. I am constantly rooting against myself being right, and this was a very big win for that school of thought this season. It just feels so strange to me for this point in the grand scheme of Survivor history to go that route, but in general loved the way that the bulk of this season was edited. It's just Erica in particular I felt like got really sold short.
But that question mark is also unfair to Shan in its own way too, because you think about just before Shan's downfall, she was very insistent to the point of alienating her own allies on, we got to split up Erica and Heather, right? Can we trust Erica and Heather? And we get some eventual payoff that, you know, Shan was doing that because she was onto Erica maybe sooner than the other people were. But in the moment, it's a head scratcher. It's, wait, we're going after those two when we could do that any time, instead of, you know, Mercedes over here has an idol, Xander has an idol, so on and so forth. And it seemed like Shan was just getting like fixated on this one person at the cost of all else, once again undermining this idea that Erica was just hiding in the shadows until the right time. But in retrospect, maybe Shan was kind of validated, right? Like, yeah, Deshaun was a little volatile and hard to work with, and yeah, Erica was someone who you really had to pay attention to. So in the cold light of day, Shan almost got like underserved by the way that her downfall gets presented there.
That is a very strong Dom Harvey Edgelord of Extinction take there, that Shan was underpresented.
Oh, stop.
Yeah. Dom, with Erica's edit in mind, now that we have seen the way this played out, the way all of the finalists were presented throughout the duration of the season, I don't even know how much that sort of thing is going to weigh into your overall evaluation here, but with all 13 episodes now officially in the books, what is your evaluation of Survivor 41 on the whole?
I think it's a season that, like, there's so much there, and there's a lot to really like, a lot to take comfort in for the future direction of the show. So the raw material is good. I am skeptical about the meddling from up on high that is going to determine how that plays out and what we see of that going forward. And, you know, coming in, the worst case scenario hasn't really materialized. This was actually a season where, as we mentioned, the typical hidden immunity idol played less of a role here than it has done in like dozens of seasons potentially. Like, it's was weirdly absent from everything that, that was going on here. And a lot of the twists felt like they were kind of just weird diversions in otherwise normal episodes of Survivor. And so the nightmare of this is going to be barely recognizable for what the show is, the show that we know and love, that didn't really transpire. So we avoided that worst case scenario. I don't know if they're going to learn the right lessons from this season, though, because there are good lessons to learn. It's, okay, we hit on something good with this cast. What did we like about that? How can we take that going ahead? Or, you know, that even stuff like some of the twists in the game or how the game played out, a lot to like about it and a lot to try and channel in a good direction. I just worry that the issue with this approach of we'll throw everything at the wall all at the same time and see what sticks is, even if you approach that with a great mentality and a willingness to, you know, kill your sacred cows and not get too attached to any one thing, when you bombard a season with everything at once, it's really hard to disentangle the impact of this thing versus this other thing and to see what would work in a different context. And then also, when you're coming to it with Jeff's mindset, which feels very explicitly like, well, I know these are the things I want to do, and I'm just like looking for validation in the way the season played out for which of these to take forward. I'm concerned, to put it that way. And I know that both of us have said variations of that in previous episodes this season and across the years. And there's nothing new about that coming from us really at this point. So I thought maybe we should turn this over to someone who has a lot to say on the topic from a place where he's qualified to talk about it. And that is Phil Kogan, host of The Amazing Race, and also Tough as Nails, I guess, but mostly of The Amazing Race. So here is what he had to say on RHAP when he joined them for his preview of the upcoming Amazing Race season. People do always ask, what's new about this season or that season? What's the twist? What's the turn? How are you making it different? I think at the end of the day, it's kind of like the NFL. It's the most popular form of entertainment anywhere. You don't change the rules of the game of football. You enhance the game by having different coverage, setting up great competitions, changing how you see it with a Skycam. You enhance what worked. You don't go in and change a format. And so we've tried to stick to the format that people love on The Amazing Race, which is you start off at a pit stop. You race, you go to detours and roadblocks, and sometimes there's a fast forward. But you're racing as fast as you can to the next pit stop. The essence of what that is and why people have tuned in to The Amazing Race for 20 years is they know what they're going to get. Well, this season, we're going to extend the width of the football field just to make it interesting. The ball's going to be bigger. No, just stick with what works and enhance the game. And that is a very pointed quote. And so as a lapsed Amazing Race fan, I don't know if the fan base for that show would agree that that's what Phil has done with The Amazing Race in recent years. I honestly don't know. But in terms of directly or indirectly calling out one Jeffrey Lee Probst, it's really hard to do any better than that.
Yes, and I agree with your general sentiments to this point. And let me begin by saying, as far as the season as a whole is concerned, one of the greatest casts of all time, which is incredibly important to me. I think, though, that this cast was so good that they went a long, long way in essentially kind of covering up all of the spots where the producers continue to just have the absolute wrong idea and are trying to punt this franchise into the sun. But incredible casting. Would love to see many of these people back. That is probably the single most important element, I think, to get right in any given season. And this is an all-time banger along those lines. Similarly, in general, while setting aside the obvious quibbles we may have had with the presentation of specifically Erica, I think the editing, which is another massive concern for me in general about Survivor, was something that made a ton of strides, and I am optimistic along those lines going forward. However, as you have alluded to, as Phil seems to be alluding to, and actually want to give a big shout out to Dave Jorgensen, the Washington Post TikTok guy, for bringing this to my attention on Twitter. He did not tweet it to me. I just follow him and saw it and retweeted it myself.
My buddy Dave reached out to me with a comment to include in the podcast.
Yeah, he tweeted a quote that Jeff had. I don't know, I'm sorry, where the quote was from. Let's say it was from the Washington Post. Why not? Where Jeff said, "The big moment in the design of Survivor 41 came when we realized that the way to change the game in a massive way would be to overload them with everything all in one season. So that's what we did." And Dave posted a photo of that quote and said himself, "I love Jeff and I love Survivor, but overloading this cast with twists is exactly what was bad about this season," end quote there. And again, as Dom said, you know, this is something we've talked about for many, many, many years at this point. I'm sure people are probably growing sick of it. But like Phil, like Dave, we are not critical of this sort of thing because we hate Survivor and are rooting against it and want it to be canceled or whatever. We are critical because we love Survivor and I think are rooting for it to be as good as we know it can be. And it still clearly can be absolutely amazing. It just continues to be an enormous, overwhelming, almost fully consuming concern for me that despite seeing how little effect Idols had on this season, what a flop some of the other advantages that they put in ended up being, it very much continues to seem to me like the people who are actually in charge of making such vital decisions about how these future seasons are going to be structured continue to just have the dead wrong idea about what actually makes for compelling seasons of Survivor. And again, I think this cast went way, way above and beyond the average Survivor cast in their ability to make for compelling TV, despite the producers' best efforts to fuck up their own product constantly, almost at every turn along the way here. And I'm optimistic that future casts are going to be able to do the same going forward. But I remain just about as nervous as I was entering this season about the mentality of the producers in particular and what that is going to mean for Survivor going forward, because I'm at the point where I feel like there's just nothing that can possibly happen to get them out of this line of thought, and any worst casts are going to be very vulnerable to producing some terrible seasons, and that is something I do not want.
Well, on that happy note, what else do we have to
given that, thank God, this cast was as incredible as it was, and the season played out in, for the most part, I think, a very entertaining way, where does 41 stack up for you? I don't need a specific number between 1 and 41, but what sort of tier is this landing in for you?
I don't have a good answer to that yet. It's probably a solid, like, maybe like a low teen season, or is it high teens? Whatever. Between 10 and 20, closer to 20 than it is to 10, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know that I can put it even close to 10 in relative terms. Like, it's definitely not number 10 or higher than that or lower than that. Whichever way we're looking at the scale of numbers here, it is outside my top 10 for sure. I also don't have a square number that I'm putting it at, but I think it's got to be a top half season for me. So I think I'm probably looking somewhere, or at the very least, not far below bottom half. I don't think I can even put this in the bottom half of seasons. So, like, even consider putting this in the bottom half of season. So I am going to say that I am putting this somewhere between 15 and 20. So let's be a little edgier and say this season for me is somewhere between 18 and 13. Let's go with that. A highly scientific process here. A very good season, though, overall. There are just a ton of better Survivor seasons when the show is really firing. It's a very, very good show. This is not like Big Brother, where there are a few really, really good seasons and most of the rest are pretty bad, to be honest. There are a lot of historically strong seasons of Survivor, and I don't think this is in the top tier, and probably not even in like the tier 1A for me, but I think this is certainly an above average season, well above average kind of overall viewing experience, given how shocking a lot of the stories ended up being for me and how long of a break we had since just getting New Survivor in the first place. So I am going to just hedge my bets and say this is right around the 15-ish mark for me, which is not bad at all and is certainly much higher than I was expecting just hearing Jeff Probst talk so damn much about the monster entering the season and being very certain that the monster was just going to be Jeff himself. I feel like we have faded the monster, just kind of ruining things, and if nothing else, had an actively good season despite the monster. So very satisfied on the whole there with Survivor 41. One final thing, I suppose, Dom, from this finale. Instead of a conventional reunion back in LA or New York or wherever, or, you know, the makeshift kind of Zoom reunion we had last season in Jeff's literal garage, I think, we have ourselves here an on-site reunion, if you want to call it that. I guess they haven't really been apart to this point, so not really much uniting needing to be redone here. But what did you make of this after show, I guess, for lack of a better term?
So I loved it in the sense that it,
and by the way,
wasn't...
I'm just going to be sitting here eating while you tell your side of things.
Okay. How long should I ramble for then? What
no,
would
I'm
be
just
the
kidding.
Best?
Just like, podcast like when, listeners at home know that I'm just chewing as Dom is talking, and it's very distracting.
Chewing audibly into the microphone, or what are we going
I'll
for?
I'll try here? To. I'll mute myself.
Okay. Thank God. This is the equivalent of when you know, the people are holding their hands above the head with the bucket in the challenge while the others eat, and I will hold my proverbial verbal bucket above my head for as long as I can here until
I'm not actually
interrupted
eating.
Once
I'm just
more.
Making a reference to the fact that the eating going on in the background was extremely distracting during this on-site reunion.
Oh. Well, okay, so I guess I will just run at length, unencumbered by any other considerations then. So I love this in part because it literally was impossible to have any random children in the audience or men or women off the street to go into the aisles to console here. It was, the focus was on exactly the people it should be on, which is the contestants and the story that we just saw conclude. And I feel like you do get more raw and immediate reactions in that exact moment than you do at any other point, where the game is officially over, and not just the main portion of the game itself, where the power now shifts to the jury, but like that portion of the game too. The whole thing is done, and so now you can be fully unfiltered. The finalists, if, you know, Deshaun decides that, I don't know, Tiffany's question wasn't to his liking, he can go off on Tiffany now if he wants to without risking that harming his reputation with other people. So I feel like that is the exact moment in some ways, but I do want to hear more from everyone there. And so I'm glad that we finally got to channel that. I think there were some missed opportunities to ask, for example, in that one moment where you're going to get the most authentic answer, you know, if Heather had won the fire making challenge instead, or if Xander had done something else, you know, those counterfactuals, you get better answers in that exact moment than at any other point. So I'm sad that we didn't get any of that at all. But yeah, by and large, I think this was a change forced upon them by COVID. I don't think that they would have done that otherwise. But I'm glad they did, and I'm hopeful that maybe this will persist even into a non-COVID or, well, endemic COVID world now, where I think this is just an improvement on the whole. That being said, obviously it is sad we don't get any of the pre-jury people in there, don't get to hear from them. Although, to be honest, in most reunions, how often did we get to hear from them anyway? And then also, and a lot of contestants have said this, there is a certain closure that comes from seeing everyone again in person and getting to hash things out, you know, in the reunion itself or just, you know, in private on location. Once the season has finished airing, like there's a, you have the game itself, which has all of its stuff associated with it. And then once you go home, there's the whole like waiting period as you acclimatize back to real life and you're waiting for the show to air. And then this whole new experience of the show airing. And so having the reunion where it was, it's a perfect way to tie all those loose ends together for that first phase, but then the whole viewing experience and the feedback from fans and so on, there's not really a chance to get closure on all of that. And I'm sad that they don't get to share in that.
Yeah, there are certainly pros and cons in both directions, and that is this thrilling commentary that people have made it 2 hours into this podcast to hear. I agree with you in general, though. I feel like this allowed it to be a lot more focused on the things that I would like for it to be focused on, and not so much focused on what the little kids in the audience think, or what Kevin Hart thinks, or Tyler Perry, or whoever, what Sia thinks. I think you're going to get a lot more honesty in this moment, especially when people have not had the benefit of watching the season play out and knowing what all the fans think, and having time to kind of revise their stories about everything. I really liked the way that they pulled this off, and I feel like obviously this is not something that it seems like they felt compelled to do back when the conventional reunion was feasible. However, I think I would be totally fine if they decide that this is the way we want to do it from now on, even if someday, somehow, COVID stops being as big of a deal as it continues to be, and they could conceivably go back to doing live in-person reunions and reading the votes at the very end. I personally think would be totally down if they end up just wanting to wrap it all up on location every time going forward. I think they made a lot of this work really well for me. So we will see what ultimately becomes of that. One actual, I guess, final note on the reunion, just given that we ended up having the votes read on location, big time shout out to this entire cast and crew who, as far as I know, kept their fucking mouths shut about how all of this played out. There is such a glaring difference in the way that it feels like the online discussion goes in seasons that are spoiled versus seasons that are not. And I, thank God, in the entire run of us doing this podcast for 10 plus years, have never been remotely spoiled on anything, never want to be remotely spoiled on anything. But there have been a few times at least where I have gotten the very strong sense over the years that this has got to just be spoiled. There's just no way. And this time around, even knowing that the votes had been read, the winner was conclusively known to people way beyond just the executive producers, and I'm sure the jury always essentially knows who wins and so forth, but to have it literally be read on the island in real time, and I don't believe, at least, that it ever got leaked until at the very earliest, like a week or two, and I haven't looked into this at all, I'm just speculating, if it was ever leaked, it was certainly not any time early into the season, and eternally grateful anytime we get a season where the online commenters genuinely don't have some reliable way of knowing how it's going to go. So,
I mean, there were what people thought were credible spoilers apparently pointing to a Tiffany win. And so you could really tell, honestly, like, so many people seemed very convinced that Tiffany, of all people, had this amazing edit, or that she was this great contender, even after, like, edit-wise, that episode 2 was game over, done train, don't let the door hit you on your way out for anyone on any season, let alone this one. And then game-wise, like, she was coming into the merge in this minority where they were getting picked off, and even in her little minority group, it's like, well, does she even have bonds she can trust with Evie and Xander and so on? It's like, there is no conclusion that leads you to Tiffany really being in the mix at all. I mean, even based on the gameplay that we'd seen, where she was, like, going haywire over, Votre or Xander being the vote, like, literally nothing pointed anywhere in Tiffany's direction other than there were spoilers out there saying that Tiffany was the winner of the season.
I remember that week because, once again, at Rob's Fact Checker, we'll regularly compile, like, what Edgic is thinking. I don't know how the metrics work, and frankly, I never want to see what Edgic is thinking, because if spoilers exist, Edgic knows them. No matter what they claim, there are people on Edgic who definitely will read spoilers and play it off like it's just speculation, and that's why I have eternally avoided the Edgic conversation. I am only ever going off my own kind of impulses when I'm talking about the edit there. And I definitely, like, in the early weeks, Shan was just like the front runner by a mile. And then 1 week I saw the chart of like what Edgic thinks for the likeliest winner. And Tiffany was like neck and neck with Shan going in to, I think, a week or two before she ultimately ended up being eliminated. So I was very happy to see that very quickly disproven there. And actually, the only reason that I felt like this might have been somehow semi-spoiled is, again, I saw the What Edgic Thinks chart entering the finale, and Erica and Xander were, like, overwhelmingly ahead of Deshaun and Ricard. And that, to me, was like, okay, I guess Deshaun and Ricard are just dead.
Yeah, and even in, like, the actual Edgic discussions where you would see people saying stuff like, you know, Erica has, like, a fairly conventional winner's edit. Bullshit. No, she doesn't. How dare you sit there and tell me that you think that with a straight face? Like, if you... Okay, I understand there are people out there who really wanted either Erica specifically to win or just the first female winner in 7 seasons, and there was a lot of, like, wishful thinking, getting my hopes up going on, whatever. But, like, don't pretend that Erica had anything close to a good edit when those same people, in retrospect, after the fact, will complain that Erica was, like, really hard done by the editors, and that, like, pick a lane, please. Like, yeah. So, as far as I can tell from what I've been able to glean, there weren't any, like, later spoilers pointing to Erica to any reliable degree, but I really did get that same vibe in the weeks leading up to the finale. It's like, well, are you assholes just back at it yet again?
I think it may have been like Give Kids the World happened just before the finale.
How do you mean?
A ton of reality alumni, some of whom knew the result, would go there. The night after the finale aired, I went and checked to see if any spoilers had existed, and I did not do thorough research whatsoever. Because I didn't want to see anything for 42 if that was out there. But one hilarious thing I saw is someone posted on Reddit, like, I'm pretty sure Erica is going to win because Sandra just followed only Erica on Instagram out of this whole cast. And Sandra, of course, always trying to get her hooks in with anyone she could conceivably be playing with in the future.
But also, Sandra just notorious for actually giving out spoilers to anyone who will happen.
So, anyway.
I mean, by and large, the only thing given out at Give Kids the World was COVID, by my understanding. But that did kind of poison the well for me in the last week or two, and did make just looking ahead and anticipating that finale so much less enjoyable for me. Right. Whereas, like,
when I saw that chart, I said, okay, I'm glad we did the podcast before I saw this, because now I feel like it's only Erica and Xander drawing live.
Right. It's like, despite warming to Erica increasingly, I almost don't want her to win now, because first of all, this is going to be some like religious war now between the Erica and Xander truthers for the rest of time. And then also, I feel like so much of the discussion around Erica's game is going to be bound up in she is finally, after so long, the next female winner. And a lot of it is a response to the backlash from the Xander people who don't understand why Erica did nothing and Xander was this golden boy. How could he possibly get zero votes? And at no point in any of this process was it going to be possible to just like, oh, hey, Erica seems cool. I'm glad she won. Like, as a fellow Canadian or whatever now. Like, it felt so hard to sift through all the bullshit and just be like satisfied in a very basic way with the outcome of the season.
Yes. Well, Dom, I don't know how many people out there even heard this in the first place or remember it, but Erica, our winner of season 41, let's one final time congratulate her on a job well done there.
There was a video uploaded of her final like viewing party with her family in Niagara Falls, where I think most of her family didn't know that she was going to go on to win.
Oh, wow.
And so you got to watch her with them as that was being revealed, like, live, and that was really heartwarming to watch. That was great.
That's great. But you know who did know that Erica was going to go on to win, potentially even before Erica ended up winning the game? Dominic, over on the patron feed at patreon.com/DominColin, back in I think it was in May, we did a cast preview for Survivor 41 based only on the at the time, brand new information that Redmond had just released over at InsideSurvivor.com, where we saw the people's names, I think ages, locations, occupations, and photos. And you and I did a whole podcast over on the Patreon feed about who's going to be the challenge beast, who's going to be the purple person, and who is going to be the eventual winner. And in that podcast, sir, I picked Erica. You literally heard it here first. If you were signed up over on the Patreon feed, that Erica was going to be the event. I think I am literally the first person on the record with Erica as my winner pick for Survivor 41. And for further for the record here, Dom, I believe you were on Xander there. So not too shabby by you either. And we are momentarily going to do the same for Survivor 42. Redmond also has the same kind of name. Let's see, it's name, age, location, and occupation up for the cast of Survivor 42. I guess we got to see a little bit of them in the preview that they showed us at the end of this reunion. So we will get our official, essentially sight unseen picks in here for Survivor 42 momentarily to see if we can run it back along those lines. Before we do, one quick thing. Over on the Patreon feed, we just wrapped up our coverage of The Mole 2. It took a little while just with Survivor actually being back in season, and for me, having football back in season, but my fantasy season is over. Survivor proper season is over. I'm sure we're going to have some other stuff going on here on the main feed. Probably, at the very least, some No More Lockies to keep people busy until whenever it is that Survivor 42 starts back up. So we will have stuff happening here on this very feed as well. But over on the Patreon feed, Dominic, we are about to dive into a new classic Survivor rewatch season. We have talked a little bit about this. Are you down to do the one that we talked about?
100%.
I am very much into it as well. Dom, how about you tell the people where we are going to be going next on the Patreon feed?
We will be heading to Africa, to Africa's Last Eden, in fact, for Survivor Gabon.
Yes, indeed. So if anyone would like to join us there, that is patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Very, very excited to dive back into that season, one I haven't seen in a very long time, but that has always held a very special place in my heart. So that should be plenty of good times. Dom, let's now do our official Survivor 42 winner picks based on photo only to see if we can run it back here. And incidentally, I will give my pick, you will give your pick, and then we will also use a random number generator to pick essentially a name out of a hat to see if to see how much of this is just dumb luck, if either of us can beat a randomly selected person. So I'm going to preface this by saying I have a weird vibe that we might be on the same page here, and I'm nervous that we're both going to pick the same person. Do you have your name in mind? And again, I'm using I am over on InsideSurvivor.com. Of course, the great Redmond providing this information. He was right about the Survivor 41 cast. I have to assume he is right about the Survivor 42 cast as well here. Dom, I guess I will give you the floor. My pick is locked in, and I do not have a place to pivot if you do indeed end up on the same person, but we will cross that bridge if we get to it, Dom.
Well, so I think the way to do this is I'll count down from three, and so you're 3, 2, 1, reveal, and then we will both say ours at once, and if we happen to alight upon the same name, then you can flounder around and pick someone else.
Okay. Well, I'm also now even more nervous that we're going to say different names, and no one's going to be able to hear which names we are saying.
Okay, well, we can cross that bridge when we get to it.
Okay.
All right, so 3, 2, 1, hi.
Oh, it's not hi for me, although he probably would have. And I'm sorry for ruining the simultaneous saying of the names, but I was anticipating you being the one to just go totally silent and leave me hanging out to dry. Okay, hi is a very good pick that also crossed my mind. Dom, I'm going to go with, how about another Canadian? Drea is going to be my pick.
Okay. Yeah, I think, Hai has a lot going for him. He's a contestant on Survivor, so that helps if you're trying to win. He's 28, which increasingly, as of last week, I've come to believe that 29 is the optimal age for, you know, Survivor or all other endeavors in life. But yeah, 28 is close enough. He directs analytics, whatever that means. I'm sure that's good.
He's going for it on fourth down, so that's good to hear.
Yeah, lives in an American state, so that helps. Not one of these Canadian interlopers coming across the border to steal the prize money. So yeah, a lot going for him there.
Yeah, Hai Zhang rhymes with Tai Trang, so probably due for a deep run if those syllables.
Is this like a GIF versus GIF situation?
Maybe. So Drea, yeah. My pick, 34, Montreal, fitness trainer. Why not? Jumping off the page to me there. And now, Dom, I have a random number generator rotating. I'm looking at it now. It's going between all the numbers between 1 and 18 very, very quickly. You say stop when you would like me to press stop, and that will be the pick.
Stop. For
stop on number 2, which brings us all the way, and we're going alphabetically by first name. Number 2 is Daniel from Ann Arbor, Michigan, 30 years old, law clerk. So the RNG is in on Daniel. I am in on Drea. Dom is in on Hai. And I think we are in on season 42 in general. Dom, are you excited about the prospect of season 42?
Yeah, I am. I want to see the raw material. The final product is, don't, you know, we'll have to believe it when I see it. But yeah, I mean, excited to do we know exactly when it's coming back? Is that a regular off season again now?
I don't know. I would guess that we will be back probably pretty soon, actually. If they want to wrap the season up in May, that usually means like a mid-February start. So we actually don't have that long of a break if we are going back to the conventional schedule. But we will certainly be here for the Survivor 42 content. I personally again, very much enjoyed Survivor 41. Also very much ready for a break. So happy to have all of this in the books. Dom, anything else from you?
I'm good. Let's call it.
All right. We will see you guys back here for Survivor 42. Probably some other things along the way here on the main feed. And one more time, Gabon happening now over on the Patreon feed at Dom and Colin. At patreon.com/Dom and Colin. But that, I think, is finally going to wrap us up here for today. He is on Twitter, of course, at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. We will talk to you guys relatively soon. Enjoy the off season. Take care, everybody.